next time.
Yeah.
I thought he said he
definitely
did. For, I'd like to call the special meeting of the Liberty Team Ways and Evening to order. Let's say you still.
Thank you so much. I'll come up here just so that I can address everybody together. So I've put in a budget amendment for a landlord ambassador program, which is going to stabilize rents and help landlords recoup some of the costs of everything that they've dealt with over the life. Sure.
It's on? All right. Was there a question about the agenda?
Well, the first one is the period of
conversation. Oh, okay, I can do that. Let's do that first.
No, but you can produce it if you want. Did you put it up there?
No. Yeah. All right. All right, so the first one is the periodic compensation review recommendation. So we have an independent commission that has recommended changes to compensation for elected salaries. I know that we do not want to get involved in the politics of adjusting salaries, which is why we have an independent commission. I feel, and I think, I hope many will agree, that the apolitical thing to do, the right thing to do, is to accept their recommendations and to adopt them into our budget and to pass the corresponding local law in order to effectuate these changes.
To the point of the independent body that did it, I think we should probably scrap their opinion, especially since the chair of that body has just given a $600,000 heating system for an apartment complex from ARPA funds, and then he, around the same time period, recommended we get a raise. So maybe take the word independent out of there and maybe not use that as justification, that body. So I'm not sure how independent it was, and it stinks to have to look at it. Before a salary study is done, can we make sure everyone else in the county, especially the rank and file, would be treated fairly? Not sure how we can give raises to ourselves. And I just have a lot of issues. I'm not for it, and I have a lot of issues. Especially
if
using that body as a reason for it.
Thank you, Legislator
Maloney. Comptroller Gallagher?
Yeah,
I just wanted to note for the record that my office had prepared a series of analyses for the Periodic Compensation Review Commission, and one of the findings of that analysis was that the county clerk had not received a change in salary since 2005, and the other elected officials, countywide elected officials, had not received an increase in salary since 2009. And I also want to note that we reviewed five other counties in the region showed county by side-by-side comparisons for those other positions, and it showed that these positions were way under our neighboring counties. Thank you. And you can, anyone interested or who's reviewing the record is welcome to look at our website where the memos are both recorded.
Yeah, and I'll just add to that, for those that prefer to do their own analysis, you have the example that Comptroller Gallagher just mentioned. We also had our office pull together some numbers as a request that came out of the last Law Enforcement and Public Safety Committee meeting. So Michael Tierney from our office pulled together some numbers. That's the second page on the sheet. You can see the comparison between other counties, and you can see the disparity that our electeds are facing. There's also a report from NYSAC that's included in the documentation. So again, there's a lot that you can do without the independent commission if you do choose to disregard their feedback. There's a lot of support for this, there's a lot of evidence that I believe supports making this change. So I just wanted to address that, Comptroller.
If I could add one other comment, one of the comments I've heard from folks is, maybe this change should be upon the next swearing in of that position. And I just want to note that both for myself and for the county clerk, that will not be until 2026. So I really think it is putting off too long. And I just want to state that for everybody here, that waiting for another swearing in or election cycle is really extending the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And this just to be clear, this is they're taking the recommendation, the figures from the 2023, the recommendation from 2023, and going straight to that rather than any stepping.
That's right, Monty.
Just a question. When comparing the salary. salaries from other elected officials comparable in other counties, if we compare production, if we compare what they have done in certain areas compared to what we have done, do we compare whether they get lifetime insurance upon retirement the same way we do here, even part-time legislators? I mean, do we compare those things as well to see if they get the same deal over there? I also hear there, once in a while, there might even be people underneath an elected official making more than them. Yeah, that's such a bad thing. The elected officials make people. I mean, just the idea that we're, what we produce, what we've done here, what you're being paid, why not have a cap of $90,000 for a countywide elected official? Why does an elected official have to make $130,000, $140,000 a year? I mean, I just feel like we're out of touch. And never do we take a look at ourselves and go, have we even been all that productive? And oh my God, somebody under me might make more than I do. Reality check. But I'll save that for the floor. That's up there. That's cool.
Coach Charlie Gallagher.
Even with the change suggested, for example, in the sheriff's department, the deputies will still probably make more.
Yeah.
Will still make more than the sheriff, for example.
That's true. Yeah. And I do want to point out also that this is not. I am fully sensitive to the fact that there are compression issues all across, you know, leadership levels in the county, and that is why I'm very much looking forward to the study that's going to look into all of the potential compression issues. So that's not the issue at hand here. And if there are any other questions, I'm happy to discuss them.
Is anybody else? I just have a question, and I don't know without any of the deputy executives here that can answer it, but the salary study that we're looking to do, will it also look at elected officials? And I don't know that anybody can answer that. But
I think by the charter, the elected officials have to go through.
I understand that it has to be approved. Well, no, it has to be approved by us through local law, but I'm saying I don't think it would be a bad idea to put the money into the budget, but not actually authorize it until we've had a complete study done, because, you know, I agree with Legislative Maloney, we've got rank and file who have not gotten increases who we should be bringing up as well. I don't think it should be done one quicker than the other. Same, Mark?
I mean, just to the point of one quicker than the other, you know, if we were going to adopt, you know, salary study changes to, you know, wholesale the whole county, you know, that can happen immediately. This would require a public hearing, mm-hmm. and a local law. So it's one quicker than the other. I don't know if that's, you know, one could happen quicker than the other. And the other part of it is that, I mean, by a month or two.
Yeah.
But, you know.
I don't think that's a matter.
It's not, but my point is, you know, I'll just leave it. It's fine.
All right. Now back to the second one there, amendment number 2.
Yes, thank you. This is much more fun. Hold on, let me grab my materials. Sorry, I didn't have something to do this. So, I have submitted an amendment for a very exciting program that is going to stabilize rents, and it is going to improve the housing quality of the rental housing stock in Ulster County. These are two of the loudest calls that we have heard in the working groups around housing. Not only that rent is unaffordable, which I think is something that many people are experiencing, but also that the quality of housing is very, very low. We have a very, very old housing stock. These are incredibly old buildings. And we have landlords that, whether, you know, out of, you know, mismanagement or out of, you know, financial necessity, have not kept up with repairs, and this is affecting renters, and it's another way that folks are being displaced is the quality of housing. And I want to definitely acknowledge that small mom and pop landlords have been very badly hurt by the economic conditions over the last few years, and I think it's fair for us to acknowledge that. And this is a program that helps mom and pop landlords, and it helps tenants. So to give an overview, basically landlords would have access to up to $15,000 in order to make repairs, accessibility upgrades, energy efficiency upgrades, or even to address their own financial distress from having a tenant that wasn't able to pay over a certain period. And in exchange for accepting those funds to make these improvements, they are agreeing to keep rents affordable. And what does affordable mean in this case? it means taking 80% of AMI, and that's the target population for who we want it to be affordable to. And then what does it mean to be affordable? You take 30% of that AMI, and that's your monthly rent. So no one should have to pay more than 30% of their monthly income on rent, and this would ensure that for those making 80% of AMI in the properties and the units that are able to use these funds, they're going to be paying an affordable rent. This is a program that has run prior. RUPCO was the provider that ran it under a different grant in a 5-county region. The program was so successful that they ran out of money, and they had to turn some landlords away. And those are now stabilized units that have landlords that are making repairs and tenants that are paying an affordable amount of rent. And I think it's a great program. This would report to planning. It would have to go out to RFP. I suspect RUPCO would be the main respondent for the RFP. And I think it would be a very exciting program.
Mr. Kale?
Yeah, so how does this work with the local towns that have building inspectors and, you know, the city of Kingston, which has a building department, right? How does that interact with them? How, you know, because don't they really have the authority at the local level to administer any kind of punishment or fines or, you know, evictions or whatever, unsafe living conditions? I mean, the county doesn't have jurisdiction there.
Yeah, and we're not getting into any of that. Well, all we're doing is we're providing resources for landlords who would be making improvements to properties. We're not making any determination as to what property deserves it, or, you know, in terms of, you know, is it, you know, if it's a building inspector having a different view. We're not getting involved in inspecting the properties. And I'm not really sure. I just want to make clear that this is not a punishment for bad landlords or anything like that. This is an incentive program for landlords that want to improve their properties. Does that answer your question?
Kind of, yes, but I don't understand why the county would want to supplement landlords who are getting rent and probably jacking their rent way up in the first place.
Well, first of all, they wouldn't be able to jack the rent up if they want to take this. They would have to fix it at 30% of 80% AMI. So that means that the properties are affordable. And second of all, these are properties that need upgrades. So if you wanted to do, you know, new windows for energy efficiency, if you wanted to upgrade to solar, if there was, you know, a problem like a leak that you wanted to deal with, I mean, these are repairs that need to happen, and they're not happening today.
I'm just not getting why the county should pay for it. I'm sorry. I mean,
landlords are suffering, and tenants are.
I would like those repairs in my house.
Well,
I'm not getting any income from my home, you know. And so the issue becomes that if we have a negligent landlord over a course of time that allowed his property to become dilapidated that required the type of work that you're talking about, then why should we incent them to continue on in that behavior? I would think it would be the opposite. We should probably be trying to work to get them to do this through the existing channels, through the building parks that they're taking the places up.
So I never thought I would be up here defending landlords, frankly, considering the last year that we've had where I've been fighting for good cause.
None of us love that.
Yeah, I know, right? I'm really doing this because I want to stabilize rents. That's the main reason that I'm doing this, and I've been hearing from so many people how small mom-and-pop landlords have been suffering. So I fully appreciate the difference of opinion on that. I'm trying to really take what I'm learning in the working groups and see how we can implement policy to address it.
Mr. Rock?
I think Alex and Moni has handled first.
You're on the committee. So, you mentioned that RUPCO will probably run this, and when they ran a 5-county version of this, they actually started turning people away. So that makes me nervous, because how do we even prioritize, how do we know that somebody's just not wanting to have work done, and then they're at the top of the line? I mean, what's the fines of mom and pop?
Fewer than 90.
I assume I'm a mom and pop, I won't be going for this.
Yeah.
I'm actually doing a lot of work right now. On one hand, there's a lot of media out there where we're pushing for rent caps for people. And so now we're going to, if I'm going to get my rent capped anyways, I might as well agree to it and get some work done. I mean, we got to be careful. We're doing all these different things, and the intent we all agree with, but sometimes government has to pull back and, I think, find better ways, maybe not get so involved. But those were my questions. How do you define mom and pop?
Yep.
How do you make sure that people aren't just having work done that have the money to do it? that you're going to turn people away that actually fit the program for people that don't. And what would that rent be? What is a, I'm just wondering.
Yeah, so if you take 80% AMI for the household size, so it'd be depending on the number of bedrooms and then the family.
There's only so many columns. What are those? What would that
be? I think there's some in the documentation that.
There are examples of Kingston and Newburgh.
Yeah. So if you go to, if you go to page, I don't know what it's listed as, the second page, the back of the second page, it'll show you what those rents are and what 80% of AMI is. And then to answer your question about what's a mom and pop landlord, it's 9 units or less. If you have 9 units or less, then.
And do they go in and do they take a hard look at the financials of the?
There is an income qualification for the landlords, and I believe it's addressed in the documentation as well.
Thank you.
Yep.
You're welcome. Thanks. I noticed as I'm reading through the Exhibit A from RUPCO that there was a mention of a certain percentage of the money or a certain dollar amount that was earmarked for the city of Kingston. Do you imagine earmarking a certain portion for different parts of the county, or is this open competitive throughout the county?
I don't imagine earmarking it for certain parts of the county.
Okay.
If there was a cry for us to do that, then I would, of course, listen to it. But
not from me.
Yeah, no, I suspect not. And I will say that one of the things that I used to base the budget on this, or that I used to determine the budget request here, was the volume in Ulster County and how many people they turned away in Ulster County after the funds were depleted.
Understood. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Fabiano?
No, I was just going to say back to the property maintenance. You know, most towns, or a lot of towns in Ulster County, have a property maintenance law. And I know in our town, I see it enforced where things, just by what they do on a scene, correct some of the problems that you're addressing right now. Not exactly setting the cost of the rent, but making sure that the property in the home is up to date, or they are faced with the fines.
Yeah, and I will add to that, you know, a big thing that I'm building in here, although it kind of happened in the first iteration when RUPCO was running it, but I've made it very explicit here, that energy efficiency upgrades are a huge thing. I mean, this is where a lot of our, you know, this is a major area where we can address energy efficiency. So I think a program that helps smaller landlords address some of the energy efficiency goals that we have from an environmental perspective, and in exchange for helping them do that, is able to keep rents at an affordable level for a specific period of time, I think that's a big win all around.
Yeah.
Chair Bartels.
Thank you. I was just going to say exactly what you just said. That I think it's an innovative approach, and I'm less concerned than Legislator Maloney is about the income eligibility of the landlord, because I think, for example, there's a NYSERDA program that addresses exactly what you're talking about, you know, retrofitting homes, and it's income eligible. It's an income eligible program for insulation and environmental upgrades to the home. But the income eligibility is on the renter, so it's irrelevant how much the landlord pays for the improvement and pays the portion. But it's an upgrade that might not otherwise happen on a property that typically the tenant's paying for the heat and the electric, so the impact is to the tenant. What's innovative is that here you're requiring that the rent stay stabilized for a period of time. My question, and I'm not sure if it's in here, is how that's going to be verified over the course of 10 years. I would just want to make sure that there's some mechanism for actually following up and checking. And also, just one thing I also want to flag is whether or not there's a requirement, and I'd be curious what RUPCO did in their first round, that not only that it stay affordable, but that it stay available. Could it be a workaround to do an upgrade to a house and then take it off the rental market? And I know that might happen due to any number of concerns, but is there anything in there that that helps to ensure that it stays on the market for a reason and on the rental market? And how do and will it be verified that the rent isn't going up? Because once it's off the radar, I don't know if there's a checklist with the tenant to make sure that the tenant
Yeah, I mean, I would be very comfortable if it was the desire of the committee to, or the desire of the body to update the language to make clear that we're looking for those guarantees, and then the respondent, RUCO, or whoever else is going to respond to the RFP, would need to address that in their response, which, of course, is a contract that, you know, we would have a chance to look at as well.
That would be great.
Yeah.
I said Gail.
And sorry, excuse me, because I was getting settled when you were speaking, actually, so I just, you just said this, I'm sorry, I missed you. So what happens if we do this program, landlord comes in, gets money, does his improvement, and then he sells the property? Are we able to enforce the rent limits on the next owner?
So they would not be able to do that because they would have to accept this money, they have to sign off on a lien for the property, and in order to clear that lien, they have to repay the money.
So the original owner has to have a lien?
Yeah, in order to accept the money, you're signing off on a lien that expires in the terms, depending on how much money. I have three buckets of 0 to 5,000, 5,000 to 10,000, 10,000 to 15,000, and it expires in that order. I think it's 3 years, 5 years, 7 years.
And the person buying it would have to just pay back the lien, and the rent stabilization wouldn't be enforced.
I'm all for going harder on the landlord. That's not what I'm trying to do here.
The person selling it would have to pay back.
They would have to pay, yeah.
$15,000 if he makes $150,000 on the property, it's not going to price too much.
Yeah, I mean, look, we
and then the guy buys it, he can just go, I'm not paying attention to this.
Yeah, and in the event that happens, we won't be any worse off than we are today, and I'll be grateful for whatever years of affordable rent we had before that transaction.
Any other comment? I'll just comment that, you know, I say this all the time, I'm for hand ups, not handouts, and this doesn't address the larger problem of the earning capacity of people's households. The rent is only one expense that a household has. So we're helping in one part of it, but it doesn't address the overall issue of they need to earn more to be able to afford living in Ulster County. I mean, it's an expensive place, it's becoming expensive to live. I think this sounds like there's going to be a lot of administrative cost towards this to have RUPCO administer this program.
I think it's like 10%.
Well, but to be able now to monitor rents, as Chair Bartels points out, we have to monitor to make sure that they are actually complying with it. They're not raising them. I want to read through this, what happened with the five county, Kim, more carefully, but to see how that worked out. I just have a lot of reservations about this. I just think it's a lot of expense with potentially little upside to the end result.
I think there's huge upside. I take, you know, serious concern with that statement because we're stabilizing rents. I mean, we're literally taking the median income of the area, addressing 80% of that, and then stabilizing rents at 30% of that. So that's a significant step forward. That is not something that we have today. And I will say that the investments that landlords make, unless it's the case of the fiscal distress, which is something for landlords that might have a tenant that hasn't paid in 2 years, which does exist, and like I know that that's a concern. In all the other cases, these are improvements that live in this county forever. These are improvements that are part of this county forever, energy efficiency improvements. Another one I want to mention, accessibility. We have an aging population, and for folks that might want to age in place, there are not a lot of options for people. So ADA accessibility for whether it's, you know, people with disabilities or senior citizens, you know, that is a great way for landlords to take that and to make their properties improved. And the landlord sells the property, that's still an ADA accessible unit that's going to be here forever. They're not going to pick it up and move it to Ohio.
Thank you.
Legislator
Hewitt.
Hello, everyone. I think the First Amendment on Human Rights is an increase from 1,500 in the compensation line for fuel to 5,000. And I spoke to Director Tyrone Wilson about how the fuel is great to be reimbursed, but there are other reimbursements for the 11 commissioners, like sometimes meals. And when they travel around the county taking care of the increase in cases, I think an increase to 5,000 is justifiable.
Any That's strong.
How much have they used this year on that?
It was not in the budget this year.
Okay.
And now with their increase in staffing, with one full-time person and one part-time, they'll be able to address their cases better.
But this is for more for the commissioners than it is for the staff, because the staff should be utilizing county vehicles.
Right, it's for the 11 commissioners.
Okay.
Chair Bartel.
Yeah. So they're currently not getting reimbursed.
I don't believe so. The fuel line is new this year, $1,500. And so the Director Wilson said it would be nice to be reimbursed for meals and other small things. So this is the first.
So my only concern about it is that we have a lot of volunteer commissions, and I don't know how many we actually reimburse their mileage for. Like, I'm not, and I pulled that as an open question, but I'm not sure commissions and committees how many we. And maybe it isn't doing unique thing. Maybe since Commissioner Gilbert is talking about having them make a more.
Commissioner Gauntlet, looks like you can answer that question.
There is $1,500 in this year's budget in 22.
Yeah.
Nothing's been spent to date. So, and I can't speak to, you know, as to why it hasn't been reimbursed.
Did they not know it was there?
Can you also answer the second part of Chair Bartel's question of is there any other commissioners?
I think there are some boards that do get reimbursements. Planning board.
Fire advisory board.
Yeah, there are a few.
Okay. Legislator Maloney, then Rock.
Well, it's just, and they may not even know. I mean, if they're telling you it'd be nice to have this, I bet we put it in the budget and possibly didn't even tell them that or explain to them how to fill out for mileage. I mean, they're going to have to go through the state guidelines, whatever, for mile, right?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Rock?
I support the mileage portion. I don't support meals. That's not part of our policy typically to reimburse for meals for volunteer boards. I don't know that there's any one of our boards that has that ability. So I would oppose that being. I'm not against them being reimbursed. I don't know that $5,000 is the right number. You know, I don't know how often they're doing the work. I would be more willing to support adding 2,500 or something like that to it. You know, or 2,000 something. You know, in order to see where we're at, and then if we need more, we can always appropriate more. But having had money in the budget and it not spent in the past, you know, I definitely think that it's probably a knowledge, you know, or understanding issue. But, you know, I don't support the meals and whatnot, because I'm not sure that's something we provide to any other board. If given information that we provide that to other boards, you know, I'm open to the discussion. But.
Thank you.
Chair Brown.
Yeah, I mean, I'd echo that, just even out of concern for what that would open across all the, I mean, when you think of all the volunteer boards, committees, commissions we have, if we start paying meals and food stipends for all of them, it could get to be pretty expensive pretty fast. I mean, what I would do is ask Commissioner Wilson, you know, as to the 1,500 that's in the current budget, how many miles the commissioners have driven this year. Obviously, they haven't yet drawn down from it. That doesn't mean that they haven't reported it. And what change in that amount of driving it would mean for next year? Because if we were to limit this to mileage alone, it's quite a lot of miles that it would cover. 12,264 miles at the new proposed. So I don't know if they do that much driving, so it's worth checking.
Great. I met with Commissioner Wilson because I often recommend the Human Rights Commission when I get constituent calls, and I want to make sure that it's a strong department that we can rely on. And I think Legislator Ronk brought up a great point about, I think there's a staff position for letting people know what services exist in the county, so I'm also going to be recommending that. But I want to make sure when I recommend Human Rights Commission that it's a strong, stable department. So I plan in the coming year to work closely with Director Wilson to understand how much gas is being spent and what is being reimbursed.
Chair Bartel. Legislative Maloney?
I agree. There's, I think meals is probably something collectively would probably save more food. The other thing is, I think this should be probably a larger conversation. We need to look at the commissions that would be, look, the ethics board comes here, does whatever it is they do, and that's it. They're not really taking calls. I mean, soil board, there's certain things you think about that there's reasons for them, and we want them to be active. But we should probably look at this as figuring out what boards and commissions actually will require almost constituent outreach and going out to investigate or help people as part of their duties that we're asking them to do, and then come up with a number for all of them. Make sure they all get explained that they have this, this is how it's filled out, but there's probably a couple of other boards and commissions that we should add to it, and I think it should be strictly a mileage conversation.
Legislator Rock.
Thanks. I seem to remember putting money in the budget last year for them to do outreach, and I didn't know if that had been spent or not.
Bert's gone.
And the other part is I support the use of mileage. I've always found mileage to be one of the great equalizers around our county because you tend to get a lot of the people in the greater Kingston area to serve on boards and commissions. And, you know, I used to joke around with Dave because one year, former Chair Donaldson tried to take mileage out of the budget for legislators. And I was like, well, I drive, you know, an hour and a half round trip to get here, and Dave walks down the street, you know. It's, you know, so mileage becomes somewhat of a great equalizer for the legislature and for members of boards and commissions. So I just wanted to make that point.
Legislator Nolan?
Yes, I agree with everything that's been said, I think. I think we would do well to have a policy, and some of the nonprofits that I work with actually provide mileage but beyond 5 or 10 miles. So it is mileage for people that are having an extended trip. And I don't know if these commissions might also have some trips where meals would make sense. So certainly, you know, something local that somebody can eat before or after a meeting. But if there is a meeting that is some distance and, you know, 2 or 3 hours is usually what the nonprofits I work with use, 150, 200 mile radius sometimes I've seen. If you're beyond that, then you have the meal compensation as well. Having a policy about that so that all the boards that do that kind of travel could have access to that, I think would be good. And the reason to look at the longer distances for the fuel compensation is it's true that small miles can add up, but it's kind of a bookkeeping nightmare for all the individuals that are involved. And then it comes in, and how are you going to ever really track that? But longer distances, I think you can have some reasonable assurance that the person traveled and used the funds that way.
Deborah does.
So I just want to echo Legislator Rock. I was about to say the exact same thing, and being a Southern legislator, and I was there when Dave proposed that. It is the great equalizer, and I've seen it in our boards and commissions. Particularly soil and water, it's almost like the reverse of the typical Kingston problem. It's very hard to get people from Northern Ulster to serve on the soil and water board because they meet in Lloyd. And they are an example of, they reimburse their board mileage, but it's not county reimbursed. It's from the soil and water board itself. I think we would do well to create a policy for all of the boards and commissions that we appoint. The model that you're talking about with the initial mileage not covered is the model that the legislature uses. The first 15 miles, I think, as Legislator Petit said, are not covered by your mileage. And I think it's fairly easy to account for your mileage, even when they're short trips, in a similar standardized form that we would, like the ones that we have to fill out, would make sense. I definitely just was very uncomfortable with meals in general. Like when you're talking about being hundreds of miles from home, that's more like a conference expense, and that I can understand. That might be a unique experience, but on a line that's dealing with miles,
The next budget amendment is for stipend pay. I was meeting with Vicki and Natalie every couple weeks, and I really appreciate their support. They came very prepared to my meetings around ideas and progress and writing resolutions. But I wasn't sure if I was overwhelming them or if I'm even allowed to use them that much. So I started paying an assistant to go through my overloaded email inbox and working on language on not only resolutions but press releases. And I was paying her $200 a month out of my pocket, which I think helped us bring not only diversity to the legislative floor, but also a young person who's studying to be a paralegal. And that would, having $2,400 per legislator would allow us to make those choices for ourselves and have an assistant, possibly an editor, professional writer, writing press releases, graphic designer, subcontracted services that I could choose with my $2,400 how to use. And then, let's see here. I also want to start having town halls in the town of Rochester, like Councilwoman Inouyen and Legislator Michael Coleman have been having. They invite the whole public to come talk to them about any issue, and that's why I would like to create flyers with a designer to start getting the public to come ask me questions, and possibly Legislator Stewart or Manager Joe Green and other neighboring legislators to come talk about issues that affect all of us. And that's all the notes I have for now. I'd also like to get more involved in the local newspapers by having letters to the editor, and I'm overwhelmed often, so I can't always write what I want to write.
Thanks. First thing, Mommy.
I think you bring up something, like the conversation that you're starting needs to be started. I don't know if I agree with your solution, but you have an entire IS department. You have a county attorney's office. I mean, in theory, as a legislator, but you don't. And that's something that we have to deal with. Haven't dealt with. We have a skeleton crew here in the legislature. We do that to ourselves. We don't pay them fairly. We don't have enough staff, and we probably have too many legislators. And these are all conversations that we haven't had it. People mention it. We're going to do it. We're going to talk about that. We never do it. We never do anything about it. And I think you've come up with a very interesting approach. But I don't know if I can go there, especially without fixing all those. I mean, a lot of things you talk about, you should have more help with. And I'm not, and I'm saying you're getting, we get all we can possibly get from the staff we have. But we probably should have a bigger staff that does some of those things, and we should have access to the other resources in this county that we're completely walled off from. Completely walled off from. So I do think that the issues that you're bringing up are valid. But I think we should be able to solve them without a stipend.
Legislator Walter?
Thanks. So I agree with several of those elements. I do think that, first of all, different legislators operate in different ways in their capacity to do their own work or their capacity to need help, which is why I think centralizing the support in our legislative office is really the way we balance it and make it the most fair. So I think that this was really more about identifying a need from our legislative office and then fulfilling that need. So, because I'm not sure if those concerns are reflected in the staff, whether they're saying they can't do the press releases that you've been requesting or that other legislators are requesting, or if it's a perception. So yeah, I would feel more comfortable in exploring whether there's a centralized need and a centralized solution. I will just say, just sort of as an aside, this is my third year as a legislator. For two of those 3 years, or one and a half of the 3 years, I did have an intern who really did a lot of work for me. The whole food insecurity report was intern. We ended up hiring that brilliant intern. I had one before that. I encourage you, there are many young people who are looking forward to doing this and getting that experience, so if you really wanted that, I could talk to you about that also.
Legislator Chair Bartels and Fabiana.
The stipend, I
I agree that this is a conversation we need to have, and we're a lot of people with a lot of needs. But the stipend, I'm not so sure how we, I'm just not even sure how we account for it. You know, like the, it seems to me that it would be a lot of work, and I would be interested in the tax implications and what kind of vouchers and what kind of proof you have to show, or if it's just, because I can't imagine that you could just write a $2,400 check to each legislator and just go and say, okay,
we've written a great help us in the past.
Thank you. But I do think that the centralization discussion and the discussion about more need for help in the legislative office is a conversation we should be having right now. And by right now, I don't mean at this minute, at this meeting, but I mean right now in the budget cycle. Over the next couple of weeks, we should have that conversation. And, you know, maybe we should be looking to that end. So that's where I think we should be going with this as well.
Yes, myself too, I agree. I don't think that there should be a stipend of $2,400 a piece. First of all, I think the taxpayers would be quite annoyed, especially if it ends up being that you go from $14,000 to $16,000 a year in pay and then get a $2,400 stipend. I think it should be done more centralized within house. I've been here coming on 17 and a half years, and I can honestly say that I have never been turned down for anything I needed to do my job by any legislative staff in the whole 17 and a half years that I've been here. Never one time. Go to them, they're able to do it. And I, you know, if we need a few more people to do it, so be it. But I'd rather see it stay that way.
Anybody else? All right. Thank you. Let's
have one more point.
Yeah.
I think that our training can be better, because I didn't know if I was even allowed to meet with Vicki, and you have a full-time employee. I'm not sure what Lori does, and I never asked, so that's my fault. And I'm not sure who we can lean on and how much. And so I felt that me spending money out of my pocket to hire other people to learn those things could be handled with a training manual. That's not the training we did in Albany, but something that teaches a new legislator how to be a better legislator. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Stewart.
Chair Gavaris, members of the legislature, Chair Bartels, thank you all for hearing me out today. I have two budget amendments that I'm proposing that are relatively small in the great scheme of the county budget, but that are quite important for the two organizations for whom I am championing their cause. The first of these is for a $35,000 ask for the Roundout Creek Watershed Alliance. I did bring some handouts that are a brochure created by the Roundout Creek Watershed Alliance. Unfortunately, I didn't bring enough for everybody, which is a shame, considering I have a box of about 1,000 of them in my house. If any of you are interested, I can bring some more this evening to our session. The Roundout Creek Watershed Alliance is a group that I have personally been involved with for about 6 years. I was one of the people who helped resurrect the group after it kind of fell by the wayside. Manager Joe Green actually was involved with the starting of its first incarnation. In its second incarnation, we have worked with a lot of other nonprofit groups. Specifically, we've done a lot of work with Riverkeeper, and we worked on a whole bunch of different projects, including the Department of the Environment. We've also worked with the DEC in their Trees for Trips program. One of the projects we worked on several years ago was a cleanup in the Ellenville area of the Vernoy Kill. And actually, we were very fortunate enough to work with incoming county executive Jen Metzger on that project. And also, we worked with the Cornell Cooperative Extension on that project. done a lot of work at Trees for Tribs. We have worked with Riverkeeper to do water testing on tributaries feeding into the Roundout. The group was founded, or refounded rather, to kind of work with the municipalities in the Roundout Creek watershed to serve as an advocate for the creek itself, as to press for environmental causes, for clean water, and for a creek in which people can kayak and fish and enjoy the great natural beauty that our county is so famous for. We ran into a couple of problems with this initially because the Roundout Creek Watershed Alliance has worked on a real shoestring budget for many years. And we realized that in order to kind of take it up to the next level, that we needed to basically find a sponsor, a larger organization, who would kind of take us under their wing and help serve administrative functions and also expertise. We were looking for expertise with social media and that sort of thing. And I'm very pleased that we, the Roundout Creek Watershed Alliance, was able to approach the Hudson River Watershed Alliance to kind of come to our aid. The Hudson River Watershed Alliance is what is your tax designation?
501c3.
Thank you. It's a 501c3. And they have, generously offered to work with the Roundout Creek Watershed Alliance and have one of their administrative people help the group do its kind of day-to-day work. And we're also planning to work with them on specific events and social media. And I have with me today Emily Vale, who is the director of the Hudson River Watershed Alliance. And she's just going to share with you guys a few words to kind of explain what it is that they do. So, Emily Vale.
Thank you, Legislator Stewart. Hi, everyone. Emily Vale, Executive Director of the Hudson River Watershed Alliance. We are a regional nonprofit based here in Kingston that works across the Hudson River watershed to unite and empower communities to protect our shared waters. We do a number of education and capacity building programs for volunteer watershed groups like the Roundout Creek Watershed Alliance, municipalities, and many other partners. And we also provide targeted technical assistance to our community-based watershed groups on particular projects that are of need. So we've been working closely with the Roundout Creek Watershed Alliance over the past year. Over the summer, the Hudson River Watershed Alliance came in to facilitate a strategic session to think about what kind of capacity needs there were and how we might get started on that. With support from a New York State Department of Environmental Conservation grant, we also led a land use training in partnership with Pace University for municipal leaders in the Roundout Creek watershed along with the Esopus Creek watershed, and this continued to come up as a theme, a real need for intermunicipal coordination and capacity building. And so in this particular proposal, we're going to be working on developing an action plan specifically for the Roundout Creek Watershed Alliance to better understand the needs on governance, on operations, in really building the organization out so that they can bring in a coordinator and really hit the ground running with implementation. We're hoping to organize the annual Roundout Creek Summit. This has been an annual event that brings together science and updates and is really a great place to convene around Roundout Creek issues. We'll update communications materials, websites, social media, and so on, and also, really critically, I think, define that organizational structure so that the group can be sustainable. And really, as an all-volunteer organization, the Roundout Creek Watershed Alliance doesn't have a fiscal sponsor, and the Hudson River Watershed Alliance would be stepping into that role to make sure that this work gets done and really lay the foundation so the group can become its own 501c3 if that's of interest, or really build the capacity to take those next steps. I also wanted to mention that in terms of the funding, much of the funding would be spent on Hudson River Watershed Alliance staff time. That would be myself and our program specialist. There's some training funds, materials for the summit, outreach materials, And we plan to work really closely with the Ulster County Water Quality Coordinating Committee. There are 11 municipalities within Ulster County within the Rondell Creek watershed, so that would be directly supporting 11 municipalities. But also we anticipate really countywide benefits by coordinating with the County Water Quality Coordinating Committee on some of those training needs, and also sharing some of these lessons learned with the municipalities that are in both the Wallkill and the Osobis Creek watersheds as well.
Emily, thank you all so much. Does anyone have any questions for Emily?
All right, thank you.
Great.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. Great. And then, let's see, for our my next budget amendment, again, I brought back up today. this budget amendment is an ask for $6,880, and this would be to fund a mentorship program for the Ulster County Historical Society and the Bevier House Museum. For those of you who are not familiar with this group, the Bevier House is a museum on 209 in North Marbletown, and it really is just one of the great institutions in my district. And they've been doing great work for a long time, informing people about the history of our great county. This particular ask for $6,800 thereabouts would be to fund their mentorship program, in which the director and the staff of the museum would be working with folks who are interested in pursuing curatorial administration. Did I say that right? Yes. Almost. Working in, as curators and administrators in museums. And I have with me today Pamela Herrick, who is the new director of the Ulster County Historic Society. You just started?
In August.
In August, yes. So she is relatively new to this position. And I know that, I know many people who serve on their board of directors, and I hear just great things. So Pam was going to just share with you guys a few words to explain more about what this mentorship program would do.
Thank you. It was nice to meet you. So I am the director at the Ulster County Historical Society, and you may not know that the oldest historical society in New York State is the Ulster County Historical Society. It was founded in 1859. Currently, the board this year made the decision to hire for the first time a professional museum director, that's me. It's a half-time position and the only paid position for the Historical Society. So it's largely been a volunteer board and volunteer corps-run organization. We are about to do a big lift for this museum. We're undertaking a very different approach to fundraising, to developing membership, to doing public programming, and for us that means exhibitions and other programming that supports those exhibitions. And so what we're looking to do is this. As a woman who's 58 years old, I went through a job search post-COVID, and I discovered some really sobering realities when looking for work to administer a cultural organization in our region. One of the things that we have an opportunity to do with this request is to, I really see this as a jobs training program, to provide, yes, young people that are just out of college, perhaps an extraordinary gap year high school student, an opportunity to learn how to effectively administer a cultural not-for-profit organization, because that's what we're going to be doing. But I also see it as a chance for people who may have left the job force, whether they were caring for someone else, or whether they're looking to make a career change, to refresh their skills, to end up with a new reference, to have a project that would come out of our work together so that they've done some project-based learning and built a portfolio. And one of the things we'd like to do is we really see this as a model. So at the close of the six-month internship, mentorship, what we'd like to do is offer a free workshop to not-for-profit cultural organizations in Ulster County where we can share the model. And our hope is that this model could be repeated in other organizations to really build up a core of people who can effectively and efficiently manage not-for-profit cultural organizations. that workshop will offer the mentee an opportunity to develop a network, because they'll be in a room presenting their final project to people who administer other cultural not-for-profits in Ulster County. I realize it's a small request, but it's huge to us, because this would be a second pair of hands on duty as we do a big lift for our organization.
Excellent. Does anyone have any questions?
Mr. Sederock?
Thanks. I guess my first question, is, and this is a frequent one when people come for a specific project in the county budget, is have you explored other sources of revenue, other sources of money for this before coming to look for the county budget funds?
Yes. We were working on creating this program outline when our legislator reached out to us and asked if we had an area of need. So actually, this is the first place we're coming. We have recently received a $5,000 unrestricted operating gift from the J.M. Kaplan Fund, which is the first time they funded the organization. So we are actively engaged in fundraising, but this is actually the first chance.
The second question I had is, have you reached out to either of the colleges or any of the other higher education institutions around the area, BOCES, any place else that would typically,
yes,
have things like this, especially New Paltz with the Dorsky Museum and everything else that they've got going on there, and their fine arts programs are some of the best in the region.
Mm-hmm.
Have you reached out to them for help as well?
Yeah, the part of this project is to reach out to them. I also have talked to, and I'll get her name for you, for the county has an office of employment,
mm-hmm,
with the database available of people that are job seekers. I've already talked with the person who manages that, because we'd like to integrate with that and make sure that this mentorship program is listed there. Yes, and we would absolutely go to BOCES, Ulster Community College, and all of the colleges in the area. I also would like to reach out to faith group leaders in the county, individually, and say, who do you know, who is in your parish, in your congregation, that needs this kind of support, someone that might be making that career change or look to re-enter the job market. So we really see it as a jobs program for one person.
Did you say no?
Yes, I agree with the, this is, seems like a really important thing to do, and I'm glad to learn that we have the oldest historic society in New York State. And providing some support to the historical society makes sense to me. What I would ask is, if we are going forward with this, that we really look at it not only as a kind of model program for the person coming in to be mentored, but also, your skill set suggests that you could help the county do a pilot of how to do this kind of mentorship. And also, I would say, where to go to look for funding, because I think there are many organizations in Ulster County that could fund this type of thing. And it wouldn't be good for Ulster County, I think, as a county, to be doing all of it if you show how good it is to do this kind of program.
Hmm.
So if you can, even though you might get funding from us, maybe build in the notion of where future funding you might think of it as, and funding for other organizations who might want to do something.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think seeing this as a pilot year and developing the model and then looking for funding for that model on an ongoing basis is a really good idea.
And I didn't say, but meant to, that also if you would check in with the Ulster County Department of Tourism, which I'm sure you're already connected with, but they might be able to help you with your workshop promotion,
mm-hmm,
and things like that.
Actually, Moni?
Do you have someone in mind, or have you talked to anybody about this position?
You mean the mentee himself?
Yeah.
No, we want to do a really comprehensive countywide search. Yeah, that's part of the project itself. Yeah.
Anybody else?
One more. So this is one person for the whole year?
It's one person for 6 months. It's 12 hours a week. Yeah, so we'd like to begin in January and go through July. So it would be 12 hours a week, one person, and then the workshop would happen at the end of that period.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Chair Rivers, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, folks.
Commissioner You're going to. You're up. I think she doesn't have a conflict anymore.
I'm fine.
You're good?
Go ahead.
Okay.
These amendments are truly technical amendments brought about by the Joint Committee of Ways and Means and Capital Projects Committee. Amendment number 7 is for the capital project for open space and recreation. They were in the program, they were called funds. We're going to change the word fund to program because that's truly what they are. So it would be open space and recreation program and the affordable housing program. Again, very technical in terms of the amendments. That's amendment number 7. Any questions? Again, these were kind of recommendations out of that joint meeting we had. Amendment number 8, the description in the capital project was the community development program. The project description, you can see in the amendment that's provided, kind of striking what the description was and inserting a new description to fit more closely what it truly is. And again, this was a recommendation of that joint committee. Truly technical amendment. In like 10 minutes, just moving along.
Boy. Just moving along.
There you go.
Yeah. You're, make up for lost
You're
time.
Earning us money back.
There you
You're
go.
Earning
exactly.
us time back.
Amendment number 9 is for the county storage and warehouse facility. With this amendment, we're moving the construction to the year 2024 instead of, I believe, it was in 2023. Mm-hmm. So we're moving that to 24. The design would be in 23, construction in 24. Truly what that amendment is. On to amendment number 10, the Government Operations Center. Again, the amendment to this is about the construction costs. Construction was originally listed in 25 and 26. We've moved it up from to 24 and 25. So that moved up a year from where it was in the program.
Chair Bartels?
I know that it's on the resolution tonight, but these numbers, the prior years, the 1.3, is it meant to be that the 1.353 and the 2.146 is the combination of the acquisition and any other studies? Does that cover where we're at?
Dominique, go ahead.
Yeah, 1.353 is what's currently been approved by resolution. Six is the, yeah, essentially that's what's going to be the net together tonight.
Okay. Thank you.
Any others on that one? Amendment number 11 is the roof replacement program. In this, the description said to date expenses are $1 million in design and $900,000 in construction. The $900,000 is being zeroed. Just for the $1 million in design. Again, that came out of that committee. Let's see. Amendment number 12, the Trudy Resnick Farber Building Repairs Project. No financial changes to this amendment. In the description, we're going to add in-house labors to be used for a portion of this work. Mm-hmm. It wasn't in there, so we're going to just put it in there as part of the project. And the last one, in terms of the capital improvement program, is for the UCAP facility modernization project. We use the word, it should be over time instead of overtime. That's all that is. that was a play on a word, is what that one is.
Chair Bartels.
Thanks. I begin by saying, however technical they seem, I do appreciate the changes. I'm gonna be bringing some changes to capital tomorrow. You know, I just want to say, on balance, the capital program is a concern to me. I mean, this is just you. It's something that we always look at. We in the legislature were asked to approve this projection of 5-year plan, and then
later things come back and said, well, you approve them in the capital plan, and that's what I normally talk about. But my concern about this capital program, it's funny because I have with me the 16 to 21 because I happened to find it on my desk at home. The 16 to 21 with all but, I want to say one, but it might be two exceptions, were actually real verifiable capital investments. You could go right down, you could look, and you could say, okay, that's a building, that's a purchase, that's a this. And there were two things in there that did not get funded. And in large part, I say they didn't get funded because the legislature never brought forward a policy or a program behind it, and the executive never brought forward the same. So all we had was a thing in the plan. You know, that was it. The book's like this wide, right? We could also look, you know, in the beginning of the capital that you presented to us has the history of, you know, what we've spent on capital over the last few years. If we were to take this as a real document that we're really approving and we're really planning on enacting, we're in really big trouble because we are proposing to basically triple our capital investment over the average year over year over year for 6 years. Like, I can't even in the and I'm sure you'll concur, Commissioner, that if we were to do that based on now today's borrowing, we're talking about an explosion of debt service, much less the real question, and it's not rhetorical, is could, if we said yes, could we actually really undertake all these projects? And if the answer is no, then I think we have a bigger issue here. And I know this isn't what you're bringing with these tech. I'm happy for the tech.
No, but I'm saying
that we really do have to have this conversation, and with the new executive, depending on what we do with the book itself, I think we need to say to the new executive, or through the new executive to the executive administration, there needs to be a prioritization of what's realistic, and then we have to get the book to match. On the flip side, some of what I'm going to talk about tomorrow is that, and I'm only bringing it up now because we have many extra minutes.
I just saved you a lot.
Because we're talking about capital, but some of what I'm going to talk about tomorrow too is that I think it's okay not to put things that aren't capital in the capital. I'm in no rush to assign $30 million to something with a name. I'd rather have the real conversation about what the policy is going to be behind it. What's the plan? And then, not something we've ever not done before, amend the capital to put in the actual project we're proposing rather than have this massive. I mean, I think for those who are at the joint meeting, you can see that I was actually, this capital stressed me out. I mean, I saw it, and it's hard for me to process. I've never seen it. I've been here a long time, and I've never seen a capital quite like this with that much that's not only in volume, but that much that's not capital. I think part of it has come about as a result of ARPA, and I'm not going to say the three words, but we wanted to do this a different way. We wanted to have capital accounted for in capital, and the things that weren't capital not to be capital, and that we let that argument go. So now we have a lot in here that's not capital, and now we're just sort of building on that with these broad suggestions. So we'll talk about it tomorrow. I'm not saying you did it, Commissioner, but I'm just saying that.
But your concern about the amount of money, just using today's rates, roughly 4% in terms of long-term bonds, every $5 million is roughly $470,000 a year for 15 years, for 17 years.
And is this like, I think it's, I don't have the number in front of me, I feel like it's $36 million or something like that for next year.
Well, in terms of the actuals, each year it's $90 million.
What's proposed?
You have $90 million over the next 2 years.
Yeah, okay.
So that's $180 million in 2 years.
Yeah.
In the program.
Right. That's crazy. Yeah. I mean, we need to have a real conversation. We don't. Nor do we have the ability, I don't think. I don't think anyone on the executive team would say we could actually implement all
that. No. And, you know, in terms of, I think I've gone through this, until the project's done, we're not going to go out and do that long-term bonding. So these projects are going to take a lot, too.
Thank you.
Ashley, Molly?
Just to build on, I was at the meeting you were talking about. Whenever I talk to accountants about
plans, the first thing that always comes out of my mouth, well, it's just a wish list. So that is kind of, and it's, I think it's our responsibility collectively to make it less of a wish list. We could probably prioritize a little more what the document that we get, that, you know, put the wishes at the end of the things we probably won't get to, or be a little, and definitely be, we need to be more specific. As I'm looking at these things, some of it was like, you know, these generic sentences of what this major project is going to be. We have to know more than that. You have to know more. I know this is a lot of planning, but in the coming years, I think we got to do a better job of, and maybe getting some of these things out of there. We're not doing the friggin' elevators. Get them out, you know, but we have to be more specific. And, you know, we have a lot of projects going on, right, whether it's Elizabeth Street and all these different things, and where are we on it? I've been asking people, and people don't even know where we are at on some of these things. And I think it's all related. When you have a capital plan that's this generic, this bloated, this big, no prioritizing, we're spread kind of thin. We have to do a better job of saying, this is what we're going to get done. Now we're moving things up a year or two. We haven't even approved it. We're moving it up a year or two. We don't know. It looks like we're probably going to do this place out in New Paltz. We don't know what we're really getting into with that property. So, but we just moved it up a year. It really is. This is a true, this capital plan is a true wish list, and it needs to be less of one. More of a comment than a question.
Let's take care.
Thank you. So, you know, kind of going off of what Chair Partell said was, you know, we're undergoing a space utilization study, right? And if everything works out great and they come back with a lot of suggestions where we can be more efficient and relocate people to a better place, you know, that's going to have a huge dollar sign attached to it, right? And so for me, I would much rather see some of those capital projects that are wish listing type of things, you know, taking those off and take some of that money and put it towards what we're going to actually have. Right, because we are going to have expenses related to the space study, right? So, and also the personnel study, right? We're going to have money associated with that when it's all said and done. So, you know, for me, I'd much rather, you know, see some of that money allocated for things that we are actually going to have to deal with in the next 2 or 3 years here, rather than something that we hope we can get to at some point down the road.
Just that, Legislator Mellon, I know you mentioned about prioritizing. My one concern on some of those, you have roads, bridges, things like that, picking which one would go first. And I'm not saying that would
be
a priority.
That's what we're actually going to do.
Right. Yeah, no, agreed. It's just,
we're not
right.
Gonna do it.
It's just, you know, public safety and things like that. That's all.
Yep. That would go into prioritizing.
Yep.
Legislator Mellon?
I appreciate the Commissioner for opening up this discussion. I think we should bear in mind that sometimes by having a project conceptually in a document provides a placeholder if funding becomes available. And I've seen that work in this county to do $1 million plus projects. The Hudson Valley Rail Trail got started because it had a planning study on a shelf somewhere. But I agree with the comments that we don't seem to have an easy way to identify which projects are moving ahead, and that would be helpful. So maybe some kind of color coding, you know, green for projects that are going, yellow for ones that look like they might, and orange, because I don't want to put anything in red, for the ones that are, you know, kind of stalled, could help as we're looking at things. And if we start to have more green and yellow projects than we have money, then that's what I think we do each year, the planning, moving from conceptual to detailed design and implementation by moving a project forward and funding it. And we should be, it'd be nice to have that information very easily available to us, maybe in spreadsheet form.
Do we have a project management software? Do we use any systems?
In terms of for the project itself or tracking finances?
No, for project itself.
We have, short answer is no. We have PubWorks we use in-house for our internal staff at DPW, and then you have a fleet of, next year if it gets approved, 3 project managers and a deputy at DPW who manages those staff.
I mean, it's late in the game for this year, but I would encourage for next year to present to us some options for project management software that would give transparency to where we are, to Legislator Maloney's point, where we are in these projects that we're approving, how far along it's going to be, and it'll actually help everyone to see what we can realistically do in the time frames that we have. I think prioritizing projects, the feeling of our urgency, you know, scoring them, and to, as Bert had said, you know, there's some projects that are public safety, so those are going to have to move to the top of the list. But then there's ones that they may be lower priority, but they're quick projects. They could be done very fast, and you fill them into the gaps where you have time in between to do those. So I think that's where project management software or you know, a service online even would be very helpful. I would be helpful to me at the very least. So.
I'll just say, too, I do know that even though they don't have software, they do actively track it. They have bi-weekly meetings where they meet each side of the house, and they throw it on Excel spreadsheets.
That's internally. Yeah, exactly. It doesn't translate, unfortunately, to the rest of us, and that's where I think, to the most point, it's hard to get answers sometimes and see everything collectively where you're focused on one set of things, but there's other projects out there. So.
Understood.
All right.
Thank you.
Come from the Gallagher.
Chair Gamaris and committee and other legislators, thank you for the opportunity to come before you with this proposed budget amendment. I am seeking an increase in the salary for three positions in my office, and I will explain why and what I am seeking to do. I'm going to start with the Director of Internal Audit and Control, which is currently vacant. That position has been extremely challenging to fill. It is currently making significantly less than the positions that it oversees, which are two senior auditors and two regular auditors. I am seeking to change the position from $80,379, which was recommended in the executive's budget, to $90,851 annually. I would just add that we have found this position really hard to fill, and I note that next on the agenda is an amendment to reduce that position even further by 2.5%. So I would like to note my objection certainly to that additional amendment with regard to this position. But if we want to get a qualified candidate who can oversee four additional auditors and really drive the audit program of the county, we need to pay this position better than we do right now. The second position I'd like to talk about is the deputy controller position. I want to note that in Personnel Director Spader's report on management salaries, this position was noted as something that should have special look because it is too low. It is, again, below by hour the pay of one of the senior auditors in our office and very close to a second senior auditor. There's a compression issue there. Seeking to raise this salary from $88,823 to $98,189 a year, and I want to tell you why we chose that number. That number was based on the Deputy Commissioner of Finance's salary. And actually, let me go back to the DEC because I didn't tell you how we chose that number. That the DEC salary is actually the salary of a G20. I am so frustrated with filling this position that I'm working with Dawn Spader to make this a union position. I'm going to be moving to make the DAC position a union position because we just can't get the salary we need to make it an appointed position in Philly. So the DAC is based on the G20. The deputy is based on the Deputy Commissioner of Finance and, fixing the compression problem between the DAC, the auditors, and the deputy. And then lastly, I want to note that the confidential secretary salary, I am requesting a small increase here. This is after reviewing, again, Personnel Director Spader's report that lists the hourly wages for all the confidential secretaries. And I know that we're substantially below a number of the other elected officials' hourly or salaries for their confidentials. I would just note that in the 23 budget, and I understand these people may have significant longevity. That's not what I'm talking about. The county clerk confidential secretary will be at 62,663. The DA's confidential secretary in the 23 budget will be at 68,432. The county executive's confidential secretary will be at 59,432. 546. I would just note the comptroller's confidential secretary and also the sheriff's confidential secretary are significantly below those positions. I have spoken with Chair Bartels about the confidential secretary numbers, and I think it probably does, especially after last night's conversation in Ways and Means, merit a broader look across the board. When I look at these numbers, I'm also concerned about the confidential secretary in the county attorney's office. I would imagine that is a very high-stress position. We've seen a lot of turnover there, and it's one of the lower-paid positions. So with regard to my three, I'm happy to answer any questions. Can't speak for the sheriff or the county attorney. Thanks.
Anybody?
Are some of the compression issues due to, didn't we raise the salaries of the auditor and senior auditor in the last couple of budgets? I'm just trying to remember back.
You know, I don't know, maybe before my time that was happening, okay. But I do think that those salaries are where they should be, and I think that they're, you know, I would be remiss to say that I don't think raising them was a good idea. I think bringing them up to where they should be is a good idea. And by the way, I've looked at the salaries in other comptroller's offices, and I can tell you the DAC in Dutchess is $105,000. I know we're not as big as Dutchess, I get that.
So, on a parallel track, you're also trying to work with personnel to make the DAC civil service, correct?
Yes.
I would not support raising the salary and making it civil service.
If it's civil service, it'll drive this salary that I've given you exactly. This is the G20 salary.
Okay.
So we'll have no choice. Yeah.
I mean, I don't support making a civil service at all, but, you know, we and I have discussed that.
Yeah.
You know, it limits the hiring pool for the elected comptroller, so.
It doesn't, and let me just state for the committee why, you know, it's not just a numerical, it's not just a salary issue for that position. What we found is that because the position is elected, a comptroller, half the team leaves whenever there's a new comptroller, and it means that there's no continuity in management. And so I think that that really can hurt productivity for the taxpayer, and I'm trying to, you know, make sure that we don't have that problem in the future.
I mean, definitely. That's why I don't think the comptroller should be in an elected position in the first place, but this is where we're at, and that's the way it works.
Yeah.
Chair,
that's why there are only 8 of these throughout the state. Or
Chair Burton.
Thank you. Yes, so I've been speaking with the comptroller about these changes, and starting with the confidential is the one that, and I've been open with the comptroller that I'm the least likely to support. It's on the lower end of the range, but it falls within the range. Again, I had a big eye opener yesterday as it relates to Secretary 2. I know that's a bargaining unit, but I think that this is a workable salary, although I respect the request. And again, it's in the range, and some of the departments you're referring to are bigger departments. As far as the other two, you know, it's interesting. I've been thinking about the DAC as it relates. I just hadn't even thought about it conceptually in terms of the making it competitive, what that would mean. My first question would be, is if we raised the salary at your request here, would you still be pursuing making it competitive regardless, or do you think you might be able to hire with this extra salary?
I mean, I would advertise the position and see what we get. It's been very challenging over the past couple of cycles to find good candidates. So, you know, perhaps there would be an improvement in the pool of candidates. It still doesn't solve the management changeover issue during elections. And so I'll probably be working with Director Spader on trying to tease through whether or not that still makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, because the thing that I would urge you is you have the most experience directly of anyone in this room, but we in the legislature certainly have the other end of that experience, right? And that position as being the position that's doing some of these specialized reviews, which is why I urge you not to let the position go when you did, which I appreciated for budget, but
you know, there's this pretty strong argument to be made for having the flexibility to hire who the having the elected have the flexibility to hire who they want versus who tests the highest or one of the three highest. And I hadn't thought about it before in the conversation. I think either way, you know, the compression issues that you've raised in both the positions are seem to me to be abundantly clear, especially what you're not seeing in the one pager that's been presented is how that plays out against the rest of the office. I also spoke with the comptroller for the deputy position. You know, we're very lucky to here to have a deputy who is a CPA. I spoke with the comptroller about my desire from the legislative perspective, which I believe we would actually have the authority to do it based on the charter, because the charter gives the legislature the authority to provide for deputies in the office. And I would like to see us in collaboration with the comptroller, because the comptroller gave me some things to think about, really being specific about the required credentials for that position. You know, whereas initially I thought CPA, was pointed out that maybe, you know, not CPA, it could be CPA or MBA or X number of years with specific auditing experience. I think it's really important that we, talking about changes in the elected position, that we protect that position against being anything other than someone highly qualified. And even in the circumstance where we might have a comptroller who themselves is a CPA or an MBA or someone with that experience, I would really like to see the deputy have the same, and that's, I believe, could be the legislature's prerogative to actually provide for that via policy. I would be supportive of the changes in salary, if not of the other two changes in salary. My one question and concern that I've had back and forth with the comptroller, and again, it's not in here, is the proposed change in hours to arrive at a higher per hour rate. For me, for department heads and deputies, the hourly, and you're going to hear it again in one of my later amendments, is less critical than the overall. We know that our department heads don't get overtime, don't get comp time. We know that our deputies, while they get comp time, they very often end up losing it because they work way more than the ability to actually utilize the comp time. So at the end of the day, I think that probably the salary is going to be more important than the hourly salary. But even so, if we kept that position at 7.5, is that what it's at currently? Your proposal is to bring it to 7.
Correct.
Even if we kept it at 7, it would have a benefit over those below it at both the hourly and the annual rate, albeit less positive in the hourly rate. But I feel more comfortable with keeping the position, especially knowing that a person in that position is going to be working more than 7.5 hours a week anyway. So it's a long way around, but that's where I'm at.
If I could respond to that, Chair.
Yeah.
I know this is going to sound outrageous. I've actually had people call me and ask me for my deputy's number so they could offer her a job. No. And don't call the office. It's not office business for that. So I know that we are at risk for losing good personnel because of this reason.
I mean, to the chair's point, you know, if we're going to start having requirements for deputy and DIAC or however we're going to do it, I would want there to be some sort of a county residency requirement, too. I know that your last DIAC, I believe, was from several counties away, and the former deputy comptroller was from Albany. You know, I feel like especially if we're going to give significant raises to these positions, I think that a premium should be placed on county residency.
Chair Bartels?
I think it's a worthy point. I was not talking about being specific about credentials for the DIAC, but for the deputy, but I think it's a good point. Legislator Molly?
Yeah, I mean, I'm all for these conversations. I think that we're going to, we always get so specific. Why don't we have this conversation about requirements for a lot of positions? For Commissioner of Finance, be a CPA. Should finance, having the budget, be a CPA. I mean, let's have those conversations. Paying $130,000, $140,000 a year. But just to build on what you guys are talking about here. And some of these conversations go right into something me and Ken are trying to do and we'll be talking about soon in our own office.
Anybody else?
Can I ask what the next step is? Should I be begging legislators to carry this amendment? I'm really not clear. I'm sorry to beg your,
I'm sure you don't need to beg. I'm sure there's two people that'll carry it.
Are you volunteering?
Yeah, we'll be.
No.
I'm our conversation controller. And sure.
All right. That leaves me a little
lost. Yes.
Yeah,
the answer is yes.
Thank you.
Yes. All right. Legislator Walter, perfect timing.
Hi, thanks everyone. So the first one, proposal amendment number 15, as many of you may recall, we got a resolution through to make Ulster County a cap county, which means that we'll have centralized arraignment. This is really important. Maybe most counties now have centralized arraignment. This would allow, if there's ever in the middle of the night, somebody needs to go in front of a judge, rather than judges being called out of their bed randomly, which we have found that many of the judges won't even do it, and they end up having the law enforcement knows to go to a different town or municipality to find a judge who will come out. Often in those cases, especially lately, there's no public defender present. We tried to have a plan to make sure there was a public defender present, but that's kind of having its own troubles, as well as having someone from the prosecution if need be. So the centralized arraignment is a solution that's really, really nuanced. It's going to be set up in the sheriff's, in a part of that complex. They've already done the renovations. Office of Court Administration has given their soft okay. All of the judges are on board, which I don't say lightly because this took me 2 years to do. So most of this is already in our budget. What was missing was a couple of things, and that's what this is for. So the first is, right now what happens in the middle of the night if a judge goes out, no clerk will wake up. So we wanted to support the judges by actually having a stipend so there could be a clerk also at these overnight arraignments. And so the first one is a stipend to allow two different clerks to share the time and be there to help. This also is useful because then we can have like just the recording of the information, everything that happens there, it'll just be a little bit better than asking the judge to bring it back and have their clerk do it the next day. The second one was one of the concerns we got from municipal law enforcement was the impact it is on them if they're driving. I mean, right now many of them do have to drive across municipal lines just to find a judge who will wake up. But coming here, obviously some of these law enforcement have to drive longer than others. So what we basically compromised with is you get them there, but you don't need to stay. There's people from the sheriff's office who are there. And so we just want to contract with a cab company so we can send people home when their arraignment is done with the judge. So that we don't hold an officer there for too long. They can just get back to their municipality. And then there's just some extra supplies, paperwork, stuff like that. So, yeah.
Okay, everyone.
So this would be for all the municipalities?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We've had real issues with that. So I have a close friend that's a judge over there. And if she wasn't out of bed in 10 minutes from getting a call, psychotic police chief's got a cop car in her driveway knocking on her door. I mean, it's nuts. But I think this is something that the county, I think this makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and I'll say they obviously know she will get up because they know some judges won't get up at all. So they don't even call now.
That's a bit wrong.
Thanks. I mean, I'd like to see, some budget lines since, we bellyache a lot here at the legislature about unfunded mandates coming down from the state to the county. Here's one that's going to the, from the county to the outer lying municipalities, mine in particular, town of Shangum police officers. We have two officers on a shift, maybe, on overnights, we may only have one, now instead of transporting this guy a block and a half to the town of Shangum town hall for arraignment, we're going to take him 45 minutes to the law enforcement center. I feel like there should be some, you know, reimbursements to the towns for, you know, fuel costs and overtime costs and things like that. I despise anything centralized in this county, because centralized always means easier for the inner-lying towns, harder for the outer-lying towns. And as a representative of an outer-lying town, I've been against centralized arraignment, I've been against centralized assessment, and I continue to be. So I feel like there should be something in here for the towns themselves in the cost that we're going to. And then you look at towns like Gardner that don't have any police departments, that, you know, the state police and the sheriff's department are going to eat those costs. But, you know, the towns that do fund their own, you know, law enforcement, you know, Ellenville in particular is another one that's going to have a heck of a trip to get to centralized arraignment.
Yeah, so I will say that, you know, conversations have been had with all the municipal law enforcement. One of the things they agree is, and I don't know about your town and your judge, but they're already doing it, because some of these judges don't come out at all. So they end up going a few municipalities over, and they have to sit and wait until it's done. And so, you know, this has been done in several other counties, and we went and talked to those counties, and they definitely find that this is a more efficient, effective way to go. But this is why we ask that they don't have to stay at all. This is what the car service is for.
Is it a follow-up on that, or?
It is.
Okay.
Any of those counties that, you know, in any way match the geographic size of Ulster County?
I mean, I would say at this point, I don't know, Chris, if you know, I believe like 23 counties right now have centralized.
27 at this point.
Yeah, so some of them do. And interestingly, there were challenges and pushback. I mean, even the judges who are saying, I have to travel, I used to go just outside my door. But the reality is that this has just been found to be not only more effective, but it actually then means that everyone who goes in front of a judge is going in front of somebody, you know, they're going to have a public defender present, they're going to, you know, it's going to be a fairer trial for, or option, arraignment for that individual. And so anyone who had sort of initial kind of concerns from these other counties found pretty quickly that this was a much more effective way all around.
Legislative money.
Before a centralized police force, I talked to you about it. That's
yeah.
But this guarantee, it's just too often that something happens in the middle of the night and there's not a judge or a public defender. This guarantees that we're going to have this in place. The only downside that I can hear is that some people have to drive a little further once in a while. But this just guarantees that we're going to have this, all these issues in all these different towns taken care of. And the only downside is a little more driving for certain towns. I'm for trying to figure out how to make them whole, but I do think this makes sense. I didn't know a lot about this being up, but I've heard so many issues in my own town about this that have been solved. It's taken
me 2 years to get to this point. It was not an easy task. I will also say, just in terms of potentially maybe pushing back more to municipalities, I know in preliminary talks, Office of Indigent Legal Services has supported other counties in some of the costs for this. So we will try to seek some. And if we have the capacity to help do this, maybe in one of the ways it saves towns is by paying the judge's salary while they're there, the stipend while they're there, for example, so the town would, or some way that's reasonable on paper. So, you know, it's possible that all of this can be covered by of this, just the amendment by Office of Indigent Legal Services.
I just, this isn't a question as so much as it is a statement. I just this and the, you know, stabilization center being in Kingston, not nearly accessible to the outer lying areas of the county. I just, you know, it just shows me more and more that I have to look further into the, you know, process of annexing a town into a different county.
Go for it.
Can I just ask Mr. Wolf, so is it allowable in New York State, if you don't know the answer, for this to be done virtually? I've seen other states have arraignment done virtually, and if it would be set up at, so let me actually answer that question.
Yeah, so no. That conversation was had. I will say that the Office of Indigent Legal Services, the public defenders, generally do not like that approach, because they really want to have the time to have a private aside with the individual. And you know, this problem has the lack of counsel at these overnight have led people to be incarcerated that shouldn't have been. And so I do, there probably are some other barriers as well. During COVID, they did do a lot of virtual, which actually is when they realized that centralized arraignment was so useful because they recognized there are so many efficiencies they could do. But I think in general, the indigent legal services, those who are defending those, are not a big fan of this. We do have, and I don't know if OCA would approve it. I mean, OCA had to approve the site, and look, you know, specifically they came and did a site visit. So, no other county does it in that way. Should we have another pandemic, that might be a time it'll get tested.
No other states do it that way, and they've done it pre-pandemic. They do virtual arraignments and throughout the entire state.
The overnight arraignments?
Yeah,
or they
the overnight.
Have, yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of other elements that would need to be in place, like the person needs to be able to have some side room that they can have a private conversation with
their
counsel.
The ones that I've seen is that the police departments have a set up a room specifically for this, each police department does, and it goes to a central court, I guess, and then they have the opportunity first to speak with their counsel, and then it goes in front of the judge, and it's what the officers don't have to go anywhere.
Yeah, I understand that. I would say that the cost of putting one of those in every single police department might be the same price, if not more, than doing the centralized. But this is how New York seems to find the most nuanced solution right now, and I think it'll be a huge benefit for us. Plus, we have already approved a resolution to do centralized arraignment, so this is just covering the taxi and the clerks. We could do it without the clerks. I think it's better we do it with the clerks.
And I'll just say, as another comment, you know, this is again where, so I'm assuming, and I'm going to say that, you know, pretty presumptively, that we're not going to be taking any money back from the judges in the municipalities that already have courts. So, again, we're now trying to solve a problem because the judges are refusing to do something that for years was part of their job. They got elected. They were supposed to wake up in the middle of the night. And I do have that issue in Ellenville. Our police officers have had to take people as far as to Marbletown Court and sometimes even to Hurley because none of the judges, including our own, would get up. And since, because of that, actually, we've dissolved the village court, and it's now part of the towns. And even that isn't going to help with getting the judges out.
Yep. But in the end, it's the person who's in front of the judge I care about the most.
Yeah.
And now they'll have a schedule that they'll be relying on each other. I mean, I'll tell you, this is part of why it took so many years, is the judges pushed back until they realized that this is so much smarter for them because they'll know exactly when they're on. And they don't have to wake up in the middle of the night. They just have to do the nights that they're scheduled. And so they realize that this is just... So I think we'll have more judge engagement this way because they'll know when they're on.
Does this schedule public defenders? Are they doing the same thing? Because that's been an issue.
Yeah, so
as well.
Public defenders right now are on this sort of quadrant type thing so that they can get to those different courts. And it was working for about a year or two, and then it stopped working. So, yes, they would have a schedule. So they also, the public defenders would know when they're on in the middle of the night. Everybody would know
that's
when they're on and when they're
that
not.
This deals with as well. So
yeah.
I've heard
that's the primary problem that we need to solve is that there is a public defender present. I mean, that's where this motivation came from in the first place.
All right.
Okay.
Centralized grants.
Next, I feel like I just went 2 pages too far.
Centralized grants.
We are now on, oh yeah. So the next one is for centralized grants department. I'm really happy to say that our budget review organization recommended this, although I had already wanted to do this before they made this recommendation. There is a lot of money that we leave on the table in the form of grants. There's many grants we get, which is great, but there's also many that we leave on the table. And with the Inflation Reduction Act, there's going to be a lot of money potentially available to our county and in partnerships with our municipalities. So these are two positions that pay for themselves. In my whole career, I've been in organizations that have had pretty robust grants departments. The two key roles is there's one person who has to do a lot of work on finding the grants and writing the grants, and then the other role is the person who makes sure that the deliverables Armet? I am on the right one, right?
Yeah.
And honestly, in an organization this size, I would see a grants department that was probably at least 10 people doing all of this work. And I know that some departments have people who do this. We have some of it happening. I mean, there's no question. So this is to supplement what's already going on. And what's also, and I'm not sure, Bert, like, we have an agreement with the federal government for an indirect rate?
We do.
And what's that rate? 32, probably. 30. Well, anyway, so
on the indirect rate, especially when it comes to like social services and Department of Health, we actually have a third party vendor that we bring in and have a cost allocation plan in order to draw down all the indirect costs.
But you don't have an agreement with the federal government for an established indirect rate?
It's all done through that
okay.
cost allocation plan, which is approved through OTDA and Department of Health for the various agencies.
Okay. So we can look into that. But basically, in a grant with an indirect rate, it covers these administrative costs. So if the success of these two individuals will bring in the money that more than pays for their salaries, you know, and in addition to the programming, because we can charge for these positions in the grants that we're applying for. So I think that it not only gets us more programs, but it will ultimately pay for itself. Any questions?
The same morning.
Yeah, I know we do. The cost over mess, we went to put some grant help, I think, in the public defender's office. So there is already some. How do we ensure? I mean, we have, just tonight, the Human Rights Commission doesn't realize they have mileage. How do we ensure? It sounds great,
mm-hmm.
but how do we ensure that this would truly be centralized? I mean, we've talked tonight, you know, legislator Hewitt wants 24 hours because he can't even communicate with different parts of the county, whether it's IS or the county attorney's office or whatever, and I feel his pain. How do we ensure
mm-hmm.
the logistics of actually getting this centralized grant writing and then ensuring that every department and office has access and is being worked equally? Because there's a million different grants out there. They're very different. How do we ensure that?
Yeah, it's also an important point to recognize that, as you point out, some departments do have some internal support right now, some don't have any or have minimal. So, I mean, one of the ways.
Them in?
Okay. Yes. So
back the public defender.
No, so the difference, you can decide that on your own. But the difference is that Office of Indigent Legal Services has a different kind of established. They have that money system, and the public defender's office needs to know how to get the reimbursement for something that exists that's already established. It's a little bit different than finding these grants and searching them out and writing them. So it's more of an administrative position in the public defender's office saying, I know this money's out there. They've told us they'll give it to us. We just have to tell them how much we spent. And so that's what that position is saying, we're planning on spending this, and we're going to spend it. But there's not the complex nuances of writing a grant in that. It's really more that. So one answer is it will be, that's why I propose it goes into the Department of Finance. It's not in one of the departments. And I think it's going to be necessary that we make sure our department heads are well aware that this exists. I know, like, when the sheriff has applied for grants and he's been extremely successful and incredible grants, he's had to pull from people. I've helped write a grant. Juanita in Department of Health has helped him write those grants. So he's searching for the right people to help. So one, it solves that, but two is it's letting all these other people know. So the one grant person, their position is going to be expected to identify these grants and then go out to these department heads and say, hey, this would be really good. Would Department of Health like to have this program that we should apply for? I think that there's no reason why we shouldn't expect to know what their deliverables are, what grants have they been applying for, which departments have they been including, and what they've been successful. So we can look at that over a year. I'd also, just the last point is, what this does, which we don't have now in a refined way, is it allows for partnerships across departments. Because instead of each department thinking on their own, what money could I potentially get, when there's a grants person, they might think of ways that two different departments may work together. Maybe Department of Transportation and Department of Health can apply together to support the desires of both the groups.
Deputy Kelly?
Yeah, I think to partially also answer the question, if you define the internal process and truly create a coordinating entity amongst the counties, then you can fill those gaps. I also think that a lot of the utility for these types of positions comes when the consolidated funding application is released for New York State. There's dozens of programs that we could be eligible for and should be applying for, which we haven't had the bandwidth or the coordinating entity in order to do so. It's not to say that we haven't done pieces of this, but I do think that with the focused staff, we could be much more competitive and much more successful on a lot of these larger grant programs. And that's just covering the New York State side. When you jump onto the federal side, outside of, you know, what the Transportation Council and what planning is already engaged in writing grants there, this would make us much more, again, competitive and ready for congressionally directed spending or other grant programs that we haven't traditionally been able to apply for. So the centralized part of this is attractive for us.
And I just add to that, one thing that's often forgotten is the importance of the deliverables when a grant is received. You know, you mess up on giving the funders what they asked for, and they're not funding you again. And so having somebody who really makes sure that every deliverable gets back to the funder, which also comes to us because these are outcomes, so we get to learn more about what kind of outcomes are happening. But I think that role is just as important, is to make sure that what we say we're going to do, we're actually doing.
Legislator Mulvey.
Was this where we're going to mandate they get 10 a year or something as well?
I gave an estimate of what I would expect them to get. Did I put a mandate?
20% of their salary will be generated in or something. Was it something?
And that was it was expected. That based on the indirect, I would expect that that the 20% indirect cost, which I didn't know what the exact indirect was that we were getting, but that if it was a 20% indirect, then that would yield. So it's sort of my back of the envelope calculation of how much we would make from indirect if they are successful enough, what did I say, to get, with a minimum of 5 accepted submissions, around 200,000, which a lot of these are about 200,000 to more. So I was suggesting that if we only got 5, 200,000 in a year, and our indirect was 20,000, then that's how much we would be getting a revenue of.
You know, a lot of times grants lead to legacy costs, so it's not every grant is something that it's free money, it's found money. So some of those grant dollars come from Ulster County when you follow it. And now we're kind of telling these people as they come in, hurry up, get a lot, and make sure you pay for your own salary. And let's, you know, I don't know, sometimes quantity over quality with language like that. But
yeah, I understand. You know, I would say I don't think they're reading that square. Yeah, I don't think they'll read the square. I think it's for you as the legislators to understand that I think this will more than pay for itself. I think if they do a poor application, they're not going to get funded. So they're going to have to go for quality. I just think it's useful to know that this is not only that, but I think in a year from now we'll show that it's probably worth expanding this grant department even more because it's doing so well. But I'll say in terms of legacy costs, that's true, but that's only on us because these don't. I mean, they usually are, this is the program, these are the people who are funded, and we have a caveat that says when this funding goes away, we can't, this position will go away. If we choose to keep the position because we feel it's been successful, then we choose to keep the position. But the wording on all of these when funded was that anyone who's hired needs to understand if it's a 3-year grant, when 3 years are up, we can't promise them the position.
And
the program's going great, then we might want to.
And we also have to accept the grant, too.
Yes, and we always have the option to accept the grant.
Yeah, so Legislative Gale.
Thank you. So, real quick, so, you know, typically, you know, grants just end up being passed through with some decreased services somewhere, right? Do you anticipate with this position that at some point in the future it will actually cost the county less tax dollars? Because are you going to be able to project it in the budget going forward? If we have a highly successful grant writer's office, whatever you want to call it, if that's really
successful, would we be able to reduce budgets in certain departments as a result of that?
That's an
you anticipate that?
Yeah, well, so it's an interesting question. I mean, first of all, if it does show it pays for itself, then that's two positions that we won't have to pay for because it's paying for itself. In terms of whether it reduces the cost for Department of Mental Health, Department of Health, for the Sheriff's Department, you know, I'm in the public health world. I believe that prevention actually saves money. And so I would have to argue that any work we do that's in a preventative effort will save money. It'll mean that less people are needing DSS services, less people are needing mental health services, less people are going into the jail, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, can I prove it? Can I quantify it? You know, that's a little bit harder, but I truly believe that the more we're providing these enhanced services, the more we are reducing the burden of our organizations. It's hard to necessarily put it down on paper because sometimes these programs reveal that there are problems we didn't know, and that might mean we asked for more services because we had no idea there was this group of people who weren't getting the care they need. So it's a hard thing, but I believe in my heart that the more you do for people, the less they'll need from you.
It's anecdotal evidence, but Legislator Cahill, the town of Worthing in 2000, I think it was 16, had a 7-time multiplier from what they expensed to the grant writer that they contracted with to what they received. So it was quite lucrative and well worth it. Legislator Walter, do you see this as potentially, because I know we've been approached by this by town supervisors and mayors, that if this is successful, we could expand this to where it could be a central grant writing department that would allow municipalities to also get assistance?
I think potentially, and even before that, you know, I'm guessing that many of the federal money that's going to come down requires or expects partnerships. So it's there, you know, I bet you that many of them will be these kinds of intermunicipality kind of proposals. And so even from the get-go, if those exist, for sure. And then over time, yeah, why not? I mean, this is the thing, is these departments rarely have this kind of staffing. And municipalities rarely have this kind of staffing. It's really, you know, it's a special skill to be able to do this. And so the more we can share it, the more that's better.
And you're looking at this as a push and a pull model. So they go out looking for grants to see what's out there, but also if they know we have known projects, they're going out there to try to find something that matches it.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. I mean, this would be what they live and breathe, which is the other benefit is that right now the people who are doing this are doing other jobs.
Yeah.
So they can't really do this to the fullest capacity.
Sorry, Marty.
Have you considered county attorney, comptroller budget as a better home for this service, or are you sure it's financed?
Like where the service?
Where it's going to be housed.
In the comptrollers versus in the finance?
I'm just throwing out.
Yeah, the benefit of the finance is because with all these grants we're going to get, it's always going to require contracts and then it ends up living in the department that mostly is processing it on an administrative level, because these people are not necessarily the ones who are going to be doing the contracts or they're going to need help with budgets, for example. Like they're skilled, they need to have some skill and comfort with it, but in the end of the day, they're going to have to get help with getting their budget together. So that's why I decided it should live there. I'm not married to it. It just seemed like the most logical is nearer to the people who are doing the budget. I mean, I'm open. I do feel it needs to be in the executive office there, because that way it's really available to all departments. I'm not married to where exactly it sits there. I'm happy having a whole grants department. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. So since I'm not just asking for money, I'm giving some away. So this is November, basically August 1st was September, October, 3 months and 1 week away or 2 weeks away. So I kind of have this trouble, and I've never in any kind of professional experience I've been in believed and felt comfortable with universal across the board raises to non-union people who often have to wait for years for union contracts to get sorted out to get their raises, that we give across the board raises to these non-union managerial type positions. And so it has bothered me in the past, and especially I guess what got me was like some of these people were hired the month before, and here we are offering a raise. And now when we budget for an amount, and Bert, correct me if I'm wrong, but I assume that when actually someone's hired, there is some negotiation of what they actually get paid. We just budget for amount, or do the people who get hired literally get paid the exact number?
It's based on what the position salary is.
But is it a one number, or is it a range, like depending on their entire experience?
What's adopted in the budget.
That's right. I'm still good. Okay. So.
Okay. I know you're
negotiating. Shane Maloney.
Okay. So be it as it may, whether that's true or not, because I would be surprised if that was true. But anyway, still, if somebody got hired for a position that got posted and they knew what the salary was and it was 2 months ago, the idea of them getting a raise just doesn't feel right. So originally I was going to say anyone in the last, if it's been less than a year, but I decided to be a little bit more generous and I made it from August 1st on, which basically means if they've only been here for 3 months at this point, that a raise, that to remove their raises, and then any kind of vacant position. And I know there's the argument that says the vacant position should go up with the cost of living, and that's how we'll make them unvacant. But again, to the point made earlier, you can work that out when you figure out if you're going to even hire those people. But at this point, I just have trouble just blanket raises to people. And I don't have been in any kind of organization that it works this way. And I'll say again, our union employees don't get this benefit of just having this blanket 3% raise automatically added without any kind of negotiation and any kind of work. So to have it in this case, again, when you've only been here 3 months. So I just made the cutoff August 1st.
That's it, Rob.
Thanks. I mean, first off, I've spent, budget after budget after budget, especially in my early time here, with management non-union taking zeros while union salaries were growing up, which caused compression issues, as we've heard about from the comptroller today. And if I can't count on both feet, on both hands, and if I took my shoes off, how many times a department head or an elected official has come here talking about compression and the need to give larger raises to their management non-union staff because their union staff are either above them or growing to be above them. When you go to management non-union, you lose your union protection. So it's like a double whammy if you're making more as the union member than you are as management. That's why I don't support this. I respect where you're coming from and I understand it, but it is a cost of living raise, and really, if we're going to go to cost of living, this doesn't account for the levels of inflation that we're dealing with right now, and in trying to attract good individuals to apply for these jobs, whether they're already in the job or not, and I think that if we start to have these, if we start to behave in this way towards the management non-union positions, we're going to lead to more compression issues. The comptroller brought in $28,000 worth of salary increases and benefit increases in her office because of what she claims are compression issues in her office. I'm sure that they exist all over the county. And I've heard over and over, year after year after year, we're making arbitrary raises to positions based on compression. And I think that the way to avoid that is to periodically raise on a cost of living basis these management non-union positions, whether there's somebody in them or not.
And I'd be fine if it was periodic, but every year.
It may have been every year I've been here,
and you're welcome to keep it going every year in the future when I'm gone. So those people will stay, and they'll get their raises.
I'll likely be gone before you. I'm gone after next year.
So my point being is, first of all, so stay with us longer than 3 months, and you'll get that raise, and then you'll probably get it every single year. It's not even a merit raise, so it's not like you're even getting it because you should. You're getting it because you've been here. And so that you'll still get those raises. You just won't get them if you've just been hired 3 months ago.
All right, let's say, Molly.
I more or less agree with what you're saying. I just think go around. I think there's management in Ulster County that's making too much, and I think there's other management positions that aren't making enough. And department heads don't have a problem, and the exec does not have a problem coming to us and asking for raises every year all over the place. So we can have those conversations. I don't think we need to do it and treat them like they're almost a union themselves, given this blanket, especially new hires, like you're saying. I agree with you. I just think we should do a better job holding the line sometimes. And, I mean, look at what we do to our own staff, and then we give out these raises to other offices.
One of our staff is in this.
Yeah.
But only someone who got only been here for 2 months. So, yeah, but that shows that it's equity. I'm not suggesting this is basically anyone who's just been here for 3 months.
Talk about the
4 months, you're fine. You get your raise.
Position by position, it shouldn't be collected.
Right, I agree. But until that change is made or we have a policy, but I'll tell you that many organizations, you will not see a raise till you've been there at least a year. You don't see certain benefits when you've been there for 6 months. I mean, you know, this is not an unusual thing to expect somebody to be here for a certain amount of time before they get a raise. You know, we get someone in here, we give them a raise, and then 2 months later they leave, you know. So I think I'm being pretty generous by making August the cutoff point. So that's that.
Appreciate it, Kayla.
Thank you. So I just want to say, so what percentage of this list are actually at this point vacant positions? Do you have a rough idea?
Is it say it on there?
I didn't see it.
I had them as two separate lists, and the lovely Amber combined them, so I don't know.
Yeah, I could certainly tell you that if you give me a minute.
Any rough idea? You know, I'm just curious.
One third, would you say?
Yeah, for me, you know, putting a raise in a vacant position makes absolutely zero sense.
Yeah,
right?
I think
those are going to be closer to those new positions, right?
Well, they're existing positions.
Yes,
yeah, they're an existing.
But they
are existing for more than. These are existing positions in the 2022 budget.
Yeah.
Right.
I believe, I mean, if I picture how long, I mean, you're looking, but when I look at one list and the other, I would say it's probably better. Amber can give you.
So anyway, you know, for me, you know, minimally, we should be. We should be, you know, eliminating raises for vacant positions, in my opinion, right? And if we have people that we hired on, you know, in August, that's a different argument. We go job by job there, right? I mean, blanket 2.5% raise on someone whose salary was established a year ago, that was bumped up, you know, for me.
Yeah,
you know, we should have these individual discussions because, you know, in some cases, this may make some of the situations worse, right? Some of the compression situations worse.
Except that in a year, then we'll have, if they're still with us, which we would hope they would be, then they are going to start getting these kinds of raises. I mean, the truth is they were just hired. They haven't gone past even like that initial period of making sure they even fit in. They know what they're doing. I mean, we're basically giving a raise to someone who's still learning their job instead of the ones who are giving, you know, their job plus one. Did you get the list?
I'm going to say it's close to half, but I could actually notate it and get back to you.
Thank you.
All right. Any more questions?
No.
Okay. So I believe my last one is number 18. Yep. No, I have two.
Mm-hmm. Two more. Office of Aging and Technical Eviction.
Okay. I
don't
remember what that last one is. But
the eviction.
Oh, right. Thanks. Okay. So I will say that for the last 3 years, I have heard from Sue in the Office of Aging about a wait list of individuals being served. I had conversations with her. She spoke to Health Human Services and Housing Committee about some of the challenges. I also spoke to the CEO, I suppose, of Gateway, who provides food for the aging. Clearly, there is a problem. I mean, again, she's been talking about this for years of these wait lists. I know some pushback has been received, I have received from the executive's office, stating that the full problem is not correctly quantifiable yet, and so therefore we should delay providing these extra support for this department. My feeling is that even though they haven't figured out the exact number of people on a wait list, if Sue is fielding these phone calls on a daily basis. I don't think she'd be asking for this if truly nobody was waiting. And so I don't want to delay providing the support in the budget while they're trying to figure out how many people truly are. You know, their concerns were some people seem to be listed twice and some people seem to be listed so long they couldn't possibly be alive any longer. So they'll figure it out. They should figure out what the real list is. They should have a better way of knowing what this list is. But in the meantime, I want the 2023 budget to have these lines allocated because maybe the problem's worse than she thinks. It's not necessarily not. And we all know that people don't get hired on January 1st. And so if they're sorting out what the real problem is, then they can figure out how many people. But she's made it clear that her perception, and this is her job as our department head, is to have three more home health aides. So these are people who go into the houses of seniors and help them. And one case manager. One interesting thing about the case manager is a lot of these services that these seniors get are reimbursable, but they can't get reimbursable unless these people get in the system. And so one of the problems with getting food to them turned out that many of them weren't in the system yet for Gateway to provide the food. But so it's because nobody, there was no case manager to sit with them and get them into the system. I mean, it's ridiculous that not only were we not, you know, that we're not getting these services to them just because these people haven't had a case manager to enroll them. And so she did get one more case manager. She's asked us for a second one. She feels that the second case manager and these three home health aides, who get paid, unfortunately, very little, would really be what she needs to resolve the backlog. And I'll just say this. If there's no group should be on a waiting list, but our seniors are certainly not a group that we want to tell them they'll get their services in 5 years when the waiting list goes down. They unfortunately will probably not need them anymore. And so this is a group that if they need help, we want to give it to them right then and there.
Thanks. Is there a reason that you wanted to hire these three home care aides in-house instead of contracting out with one of the vendors?
It's a good question. And so this is, I've thought about, so a little bit was feasibility. I'm happy to have the money for three more, and if it's better to have it in-house or better to have it contracted, I'm fine. I want three more home health aides. I didn't really, it was harder to work out with Sue which one could happen more efficiently within the time frame. So if it turns out it's more effective to up a contract to get these three, I'm fine. I mean, we've done that before. We've had the federal government give us money for nurses, and we ended up upping a contract instead of getting our own. I do know we have a general desire to have more in-house people because of other reasons. So
we as a, that doesn't include me.
Right. Tend to like to have more in-house people where in certain circumstances, because I certainly support a lot of the organizations that provide services. So yeah, if, and this is to you, Amber, if I'm happy to have this written in a way that it's allocated for three people, but not necessarily required that they're in-house, I would like her to have the flexibility to figure out which way would get her the actual three people.
All right, fair enough. I mean, you know, one of the things that I consider with things like this is that when you factor in the benefits and whatnot, you know, three might actually be three and a half or four if we're going to contract out, because our benefit factor is so much higher than the private.
It's true. And it also might be easier for this organization to get the people than it might be for us. So I'm fine. I just want the three, and I don't really care. I mean, again, I do have this, you know, I think that there is some desire to have people in-house, but I just want the three.
Does he care?
Yeah, so I do care if they're in-house or contracted, because contractors, they pay those people nothing, and they deserve a lot more money than they get. We're barely paying them a living wage in the county, and if they go to one of these private companies, they're paying them 10 or 12 bucks an hour, right? And, you know,
not less than 15 if they're contracting with the county.
All right, so 15, but
or 20.
We're still going to pay $2 more an hour, $2.16 an hour more for those same positions within the county. And give them benefits, right? And give them a retirement, right? Mm-hmm. So I would much rather see people in that field, because it's such an underpaid field to be all for raising people up and not stooping down to, you know, the existing lower stuff that's out there.
I 100% agree. I will say that the only reason why I have this flexibility is sometimes it is hard to find these people. And so, again, like, we could not hire nurses. And if we had required that that's the only way to have these nurses, we would not have had any nurses to help us with COVID. And so my first choice is it's in-house. I just don't want to, I want to take away that it has to be. Just because if there's no way, and I know that she prefers it in-house, but if she can't get them, sometimes these organizations have an easier time, is all.
Service is more important.
Yeah, we have to have the service, that's in the end of the day.
Okay. Next one.
So this was for, you all voted, well, most of you voted in favor of having legal services for individuals who are facing eviction, but the timing, this was put as ARPA, that's where we approved it, and why did we have it in here?
It wasn't budgeted for in 2023, so it's not included in next year's
budget. I see. So we already agreed to pay for this through ARPA. It just needs, it's more of a technical amendment that it just has to be put in the 2023. And
yeah.
Am I done?
Yeah. Hope so.
Okay. I probably have a ticket, so I'm going to go run in with my car.
Thank you. I should rock.
Thank you. So this amendment comes partially out of the EMS task force that I serve on, along with Everett and members of the emergency services community from around the county and around the area. This would create a deputy director of emergency management for EMS, the same way that we have one for fire currently. It would also create an assistant EMS coordinator, battalion coordinators, and then I have listed in here several paramedics. This is likely going to be finalized as a blanket part-time pay line for the for the battalion coordinators as well as the paramedics, but I wanted to just lay out with you a way that it could look with the number of personnel. This would essentially bring EMS up to almost the level that fire's at with coordination. One thing, you know, as an EMT and as captain at my local ambulance corps, participating in the EMS council meetings and whatnot, we don't really have the individuals to sort of fight for us as EMS providers. You know, one thing that was brought up was when we wanted to build an $8 million fire training center, you had 13 fire chiefs out in the, you know, and the fire coordinator then was rallying the troops to get them all together for what they needed. We don't have that. We don't have that coordination. Right now there's a part-time EMS coordinator, which I believe is funded to about the level that one of the deputy fire coordinators is. It's a very part-time position. It really needs to be a full-time position. And I think that a full-time EMS coordinator could also foster some interagency cooperation and interagency training, which could help us better serve all of the residents of the county for EMS services. This would also partially pay for a fly car ALS system around the county. It would likely be four zones. But again, it's something that we're working on with the executive's office and the emergency management department to fine-tune. One thing that we don't have a lot of in the county is paramedic assistance. Our main ALS provider around the county, advanced life support, means that there's a paramedic on board. Our main ALS provider is mobile life support. During the pandemic, everything has gone up in price, obviously. One of the biggest industries that's been hit is the healthcare industry, and specifically the ambulance industry, because costs are skyrocketing, but insurance reimbursements are staying stagnant. And the only way that these for-profit ambulance agencies can stay afloat is to take less 911 calls and take more for interfacility transports, because you're going to end up getting the whole ride, the whole amount of money, definitely on an interfacility transport that's got medical necessity signed off by a doctor. 60% of ambulance calls on the 911 system are for transport, roughly, the industry standard 60%. 40% don't have transport and therefore unbillable. So our main ALS providers, Mobile Life Support, they've been, you know, putting a lot more of their staff into interfacility transports. And as an industry and as a profession, EMS service has been losing providers at a rapid rate. We've been seeing a decrease in EMTs, not an increase. A decrease of paramedics, not an increase, because they're going into other professions. You know, paramedics are becoming nurses, EMTs are becoming paramedics or nurses. It's just, you know, they're leaving the industry because of pay and whatnot. And it's causing gaps around the county and around the state and around the country. But all I can talk about is Ulster County here. And one of the goals with these fly cars is to fill the gaps. You know, and, you know, Everett, I'm sure, could give you example upon example of someone who's in the middle of a cardiac episode who has to wait an hour for an ambulance to come. Somebody who's had 5 seizures before an ambulance is able to come after 45 minutes to an hour. And these are real-world examples of what's happening right here in our own community. The idea would be that if we had these fly cars, if a local agency is struggling to get a crew out, they could ride aboard an ambulance if there's a driver or an EMT driver from the local agency. They could get there, they could give medication, they can provide initial care until the ambulance is ready to come. It's one small way the county can try and assist with what is becoming a real problem, not just here, but all over. This isn't the be-all, end-all. We have a consultant that's currently doing a report, which is going to give us options on, you know, as a county, what can we do to help the problem. I don't think that we're the solution to the problem. I think that we're part of the solution long term. The local communities need to properly fund EMS services. The county can't. To me, I'm not hoping that the county gets a certificate of need and operates a countywide ambulance service. I think that that's an extraordinary cost, and really it's a cost that should be borne at least partially by the towns. But to me, this is a start. It's something that's opened my eyes over the last 3 years as a member of Walk Hill Ambulance, to a real problem. And I think that this is a real world solution that can really help individuals who are in crisis and who are having, you know, serious health issues and can't get an ambulance. So with that, I will take any questions anybody has.
Thank you. So I have like a bunch of questions, but they're only because of my ignorance of how this works. So first of all, how many are we talking about volunteer EMS in the county?
So right now, most is the best word I can give. EMS services in Ulster County are volunteer. So Mobile Life Support contracts with some towns. Town of Lloyd has a contract for money. The Town of Marlborough has a contract. There's also some sort of like handshake deals between City of Kingston and Rosendale, and there's a semi-handshake. It's almost like a wink between Shangum and Crawford in Orange County with Mobile Life that they have one ambulance stationed in that area. They came to a meeting with the towns, and they gave something like 93% response in those areas during the day.
So
just common sense dictates that's false.
How many towns actually have their own EMS, like Shangum, and I know Asokas does, right?
So there's Shandaken Ambulance, and one of the things is there's no rhyme or reason. So Shandaken Ambulance has partially paid EMS system. Woodstock is partially paid. Saugerties has Diaz, which is partially paid. There are some that are in fire departments. There are some that are not-for-profits, like Walk Hill Volunteer Ambulance is a not-for-profit. We contract with the town. I use the word contract very loosely. You know, they're New Pulse Rescue. You know, so to give you, and this is a very, there's a very long story made as short as I can. You know, you can operate an EMS system on billing as long as you have enough calls. If you have the call volume, you can operate a local ambulance corps with paid staff on billing. You know, not a lot of places have that, and then economies of scale, if it gets too big, then you can't again, because you need to have too much staff on to cover the calls, and then, you know, obviously with the, you know, drop-off, you know, 60% of the calls or transports, you know, 40% not. I can tell you that we bill at Walk Hill Ambulance now, but we just don't have the call volume. We're going to do probably 500, 550 calls this year. The cost of operating an EMS service is probably between $300,000 and $400,000 to operate one BLS crew, yes, an EMT, and a driver or two EMTs for 24 hours a day, 365. It's in that area. I think that Mobile Life charges like $600,000 to cover their overhead and whatnot. You know, so Ellenville Rescue has volunteers for their BLS, and then they get money from the town, right? Is that the... No.
Or a tax district.
Right. They have a tax district to cover an ALS component. They've got a 24/7 paramedic.
So the six paramedics are part-time?
So it's going to be more than six. I put those in there to give kind of an idea. They're going to be part-time, likely contractors.
So now, would these folks be part of existing volunteer fire departments that would go on calls? Like, so for example, town of Boston, you know, they go on like 1,800 calls a year, right? And they're constantly, you know, using EMS.
And Ulster Hose has, they have an EMS component, but they don't have a transport CON. They
right.
Mobile Life does the transports, and they do the first response.
So how would they be allocated those positions?
The idea would be to operate fly cars in the four sheriff's department zones throughout the county. So, you know, like it's almost quadrants of the county. You know, we've applied for a CON, certificate of need, to operate a first response ALS service as the county. You know, in order to do that, you have to operate a 24-hour service. And so it wouldn't be all of them on 24 hours, but we would have to have at least one of them on 24 hours a day. In the county.
Oh, in the county.
If we were going to do one each quadrant 24 hours a day, it'd be significantly more expensive. Because you got to think, you know, you're dealing with, you know, a 24-hour service, so you're going to need, you know, either two or three shifts, depending on how you're delaying the shifts.
The county coordinator would be the one who would be responsible for signing.
I think that the EMS coordinator would be responsible for that, and the battalion coordinators would be more responsible for the, you know, coordinating the local agencies, the, you know, and they could also be paramedics, quite frankly, and could assist in the fly car system too.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Chair Bartels.
And you answered a bunch of my questions. I think so basically there's more work to be done in terms of figuring out where the
there is.
So a fly car, what's
yes.
Sorry.
So the official fly car is fly car is a colloquialism. It's the official title for the New York State Department of Health is Emergency Ambulance Service Vehicle EASV. They have to be equipped to Part 800 of the New York State Department of Health law, which you know is pretty much. A fly car contains everything that an ambulance does except for the implements to transport a patient. So you have to have an extrication device, a short board, which we usually use a KED. It's a
are required to have the ALS adjuncts that would be in an ALS ambulance.
So are you, you talk about four zones. Are you contemplating the purchase of four vehicles in this?
So there are, the vehicle purchase is in this. There's $150,000 in vehicle purchase money in this. That's not going to cover all of the costs. Usually the fly car is, similar cost to, like a police SUV. It's usually the same kind of chassis, only the equipment, is a little different.
And do you imagine a rollout where you start with one zone or one car and one group and you see how it goes, or are you imagining
We could do that, but and we could, I guess, choose the area of the county where the problem is the greatest, but
Kingston would be a good place to start right now.
Actually, the biggest problem area is my area. Not my area in particular, because our agency is doing pretty good this year, but and I'll tell you what pretty good looks like. I mean, Walk Hill Ambulance is at just under between 75% and 80% response to calls that we're dispatched to. And we're considering that a huge win. And when you think about that, we're considering that a huge win, and 20% to 25% of our calls somebody else is responding to. And part of that is because, in that time we may be responding to a call in Pine Bush or Plattekill or Modena. And then Plattekill or Modena or Newburgh has to come to, and then it's sort of like a domino effect, But to answer your question, we could start it in one area, but I think that it's more likely to start in a couple of areas and maybe two of the areas that are most needed. The money would be in there for
Well, I can just fill some gaps in if you need me to do that.
Yeah, sure.
So Ulster County currently has about 18 EMS agencies that provide EMS services to the county.
So currently, Ulster County has about 18 EMS agencies, Mobile Life being one of the commercial ones. And then there's a handful that do receive where they pay their employees, but everybody else is volunteer. That does not include the fire departments that do a BLS response, meaning that they do not provide transport to the agencies.
But that is including fire departments that do have transport.
That do have transport capabilities, correct. Currently, out of those 18, there's about 8 of them that are over 10% of their calls, they're unable to assemble a crew, okay? And some of those departments, they're at like 69% of the time they can't assemble a crew, all right? And that's really bad. We're really starting to dig deep with the consultants into the time frame that it takes to get to a patient, where you should be under 10 minutes. We're seeing a lot of times, as Legislator Ronk was saying, out in the western southern part of the county, where it's taking an hour to get to an individual that's in seizures, and the fire department's on scene, and now they're responding to assist, and they're providing rescue breathing to this patient, and that's a critical life-threatening call that they're dealing with, and we're seeing this more and more and more. And what we would look at as an implementation is, and we can do this through our computer-aided dispatch system, is really look at those hot spots where the service isn't being provided. Because that's the problem, the service isn't being provided. So we're looking at those hotspots and staging the fly car in that area so we can get the response. What we do see is that an ambulance, they're able to get a driver there. And New York State DOH law says that if an ambulance is going to respond, there needs to be two people on it, a driver and an EMT or a paramedic. So if the ambulance can get out with a driver and we're providing that paramedic, they can then hop on board the ambulance once the ambulance gets there to the residence or to the location and do the transport. Then they come back, they get the fly car, and they're back in service. This is really like a step in the right direction. Something needs to be done. It's not the end all be all. You know, there's still a lot that needs to be done, and it's done in parallel with the study of the consultant that we're currently working with.
And again, I think that just to add on, you know, one of the reasons, you know, this was born out of a discussion between myself and Everett, and I've been talking to John Gavaris about it for a while, and Chris Kelly and others, you know, about the, you know, just the full-time coordinator, because one of the things that we lack is coordination. And, you know, one of my dreams, at least at the battalion level, is that, you know, like Everett just said, you know, we need a driver and an EMT or a paramedic. So if I've got a call in the Walk Hill Ambulance District and I'm responding as an EMT and I could get a driver from Plattekill or Modena or Shangam Valley who can drive our rig, that's something that the coordinator can help with in coordinating the agencies with joint training and things like that. So, you know, we know each other's rigs, and somebody can drive my rig, or I can ride on Shangam Valley's ambulance or Gardner's ambulance, you know, in the case where, you know, we can't get a full crew out, but we could cobble one together. And again, that's not the long-term solution, but, you know, I think that we're far from long-term solutions here. I think that we need short-term solutions in order to be able to best serve, you know, the people who are sick and injured. You had a question.
I just wanted to ask Everett. You said you have a consultant doing a study now. When do you expect that to be completed?
Yeah, it should be the end of first quarter, beginning of second quarter of 23. Great. We just had our kickoff meeting last week.
Thank you.
Mr. Walter?
Yeah. Sorry, that was one of my questions. That was actually my only question. So I'll just say my statement. Good on you for finding a centralized solution to a problem across our county. Thank you.
I don't see it as a centralized solution because we're going out and about. But fair enough.
Yeah. Whatever you want to call it, it's a centralized.
If we had say regional solutions, I'd be fine with those. But centralized is a problem for me.
Whatever you need to tell yourself.
Anybody else?
It's not me. I have to tell. It's my constituents.
The only comment I'll make is that I support the full-time EMS coordinator, the battalion ones. I mean, unless you have a model that I could see where this has worked, I just can't see what they would be doing that would justify four full-time.
They're not full-time.
Well, okay, but four positions like that, even the example you gave, if I'm a driver, I'm going to drive my ambulance to go meet up with the neighboring district, so I don't need to have somebody teach me that ambulance. I should know my own. And crossing the line over to another district, that's already done really by the 911 center. They're mutualating calls. Unlike fire departments who most of their calls require multiple agencies to come together and you need somebody to sort of, you know, make everybody play nice in the sandbox, EMS, that's the exception more than the rule, is we don't usually have mutual aid except for car accidents, and MCI events. For the most part, we're sort of siloed, which, to your point, I guess, is the main position. I think that would help us to break down those silos. The coordinator's part. But the whole proposal that you're talking about, do you have a county or anywhere that does it like this? Anywhere else in the state or even country?
So Columbia County does have a model similar to, as well as Greene County, where... It's similar to where the county does respond with a fly car and they work with the local municipalities that do have an ambulance, and they provide the ALS service. There's other models out there in the western part of the county. I believe it's Shenango County, where they just went to a full countywide system, and they 23 they I believe doubled their budget because it's working so well for them. So it's starting to be looked at. As you're aware, New York State has implemented an EMS task force as well. They've come out with a white paper that should be published soon. And we've been having conversation with Director Ryan Greenberg from DOH on implementation of how to fill gaps. So there are models out there. Yes.
Putnam County, I think, contracts with an ALS provider.
Yeah, Putnam County contracts with Amberlands, where they have two ALS rigs and two fly cars for the entire county. Basically, they operate under the CON because they operate under the auspices of the county through the contract, and the county dictates where those resources end up being.
And so Beacon contracts now with ambulance as well.
City of Beacon
for ALS. They have one ALS ambulance there.
Yeah. Westchester, they just did an RFP. They have some really serious issues in the Westchester County. You know, that they're looking at possibly contracting as an initial phase into possibly moving into some type of county system as well.
Yeah, and the 10 minute, where does that number respond?
That's through it.
10 minutes is through NF, it's one of NFPA's recommendations, but there's, I know that 10 minutes is a really tight, I think you're seeing that within cities.
Do they say 10 minutes, so you mean 10 minutes from time?
From time of dispatch.
To arrive on the scene.
Yeah.
And it's not doable.
Even if you had somebody sitting at the building, like in my district in Allenville, it's 27 to 29 minutes to the furthest point of our district. That's if somebody was sitting there at the time you get on the radio.
And that's why they look at staging ambulances. I don't disagree with you.
Yeah.
It's also based on off of call type, right? So if you get into a more, not to get into the weeds of it, but a BLS call, basic life support call, the time is actually more.
Yeah.
But a critical call, they're looking at 10 minutes.
Legislator Cahill?
Yeah, so back to the vehicles, Ken. Is that 150 per four, one in each zone?
150 would not cover four. The average cost of these is between $50,000 and $60,000. So it would cover three.
The idea
would be eventually to have all four. I don't think that it's doable to have all four right away.
For staffing.
Yeah, staffing everything. I mean, you know, and this isn't going to be easy because, you know, we're not training a lot more providers. So the paid providers are being, you know, sort of fought over, you know, by the agencies. We're fighting over the people who are already providers. We're not training a lot of new ones. And even then, you don't want somebody who's a new paramedic immediately diving into operating the fly car, because you could be by yourself on that scene for an extended period of time, which is uncomfortable for a provider.
So, and just for a dumb question, what would be on the side of vehicles for county EMS? What would be on the fly car?
Yeah, I mean, it would probably be, you know, Ulster County EMS or whatever we're going to, you know, whatever our DOH DLM is going to say.
So, can you just tell me what a battalion, I mean, it goes back to Jacob Horst's question, a battalion EMS coordinator at 15585, what do you anticipate them doing? Obviously,
I mean,
way part-time.
I think that partially they would be assisting the EMS coordinator in doing the outreach to the individual departments, joint training. You know, there's a lot of things I think that they could do. I mean, joint training is important to me. I understand what you're saying about the, if you're going to be driving the rig, you're going to know your rig. But the EMT that's going to be riding aboard your rig isn't going to know where stuff is, and that's going to get really frustrating on scene. So the idea for me would be facilitating, a lot more joint training than we do right now. I'll tell you right now that the fire battalion that my fire department is a part of does a monthly battalion training, and this year they've been working together where they started out with rig familiarization and then went to mass confidence and then went to all the way up to a live burn that they did together. And all that training means that on a fire call where John's right, there's more fire calls that require multiple agencies than EMS calls, but my goal would be to be able to fill some of these gaps with interagency cooperation, so you've got more than one agency on the scene. And quite frankly, I mean, when I go to mutual aid to Chagan Valley. Chagan Valley Fire is usually there with a rescue truck and a couple of first responders. When we go mutual aid to the Pine Bush Ambulance District, Walker Valley is usually there with 17 people. But they don't know where anything is on our rig, so I still have to run out and grab stuff. I feel like that kind of interagency cooperation is what I envision for those positions. And, I would defer to Everett, it's his department, what he would see from them. But that's what I see. And also being present in the battalion and working out, the personality issues that stop interagency cooperation.
So, Chairman Guerrero's isn't wrong, where the fire departments have a lot more coordination that goes on, and that's why we have 6 battalion coordinators on staff to assist with that. On the EMS side, I see it more as a dual role, where the battalion coordinator would also serve as a paramedic and work that second that additional fly car on the road based off of hours needed to ensure that we have more fly cars to fill gaps, right? So, initially looking at one fly car 24/7 and then the additional battalion quarters to work during the hours, example, like we find that we have a really hot heat signature between 10 a.m. and 8 p.m. Where we're getting a lot of calls that crews are unable to assemble. So that's where I would see them functioning and also perform an additional role of assisting EMS agencies in training. They could assist. We could look at training down the road to provide CMEs to ensure that we're able to keep the recertification of their EMTs, coordinating with the fire departments to provide training so they're working together as well. So I think that there's a lot of things, a lot of synergies that could happen that they could work on.
Chair Dust.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, I guess my question more comes from seeing their associated salaries being so low. I imagine it's like a very minimal amount of time.
It's based off of hours. I mean, in comparison to our battalion, our fire battalion coordinators, they actually make a lot more.
Okay.
Battalion coordinators are what, like 5 or 6 thousand?
The battalion coordinators are $5,000 with a hazmat stipend of $1,000 a year.
So could we get the backup on how many hours?
Sure.
Get these numbers?
The battalion coordinators and the paramedics, again, I broke those out because I anticipated that there would be an issue if I just came with a $445,845 part-time line with no details. But
I appreciate it, and it's very, it's a compelling presentation. So
I appreciate it.
And if I might just offer one constructive suggestion, and that would be for the deputy director, the salary. I mean, the salary. I imagine that's we're looking at a personnel line like the fire.
The deputy director is mirrored after the fire.
So my constructive criticism would be to make it deputy director emergency management / EMS, so that it says it in the title,
for sure.
It's not just the
same
as the rest of them. And if we move forward, at least then in perpetuity, we know that that's what the title and the job was created for.
And that's what Mike Gaffney currently is at the 911 center. He's the deputy director of emergency management for fire.
And in here it says FC, so Deputy Director FC. So I just would think about that title, whatever you think.
I would say EMS would be. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
Anybody else? All right. Sure, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, I'm up. I'm not going to move my spot, so. All right, so the amendment that I'm offering is a quality analyst. We talk about a lot of times all these programs that we're doing, initiatives that we set out with contract agencies. While the controls office does measure whether the contract was fulfilled, that only gives us part of the information. I know Legislator Walter has always said, how do we know what the outcomes are? How do we know we're reaching the people, we're actually accomplishing the goals that we set out to do? And currently we have no way of measuring that, and And legislator Maloney is 100% right. If you can't measure it, you can't manage it. And this would give us the ability to do so. We'd be able to start to measure our outcomes, develop models to see how many people we're actually serving. And then I think this will also lead us to identify gaps in service where the need far outweighs the resources that we're putting towards things. So it'll help us in a budgeting standpoint to determine more departments needing more funds and others maybe needing less.
Yeah, I first heard about this the other night and liked the idea. I'd like to see the job description. I brought up the idea of starting to survey voluntary surveys for a lot of people. We contract out for so many through so many different not-for-profits, and I've had some constituents with issues with some of the services they get. I think if I didn't know them personally, I would have never heard about it. And it's things that probably could be addressed and fixed. Sometimes it would involve money, sometimes it won't, but how do we know? And I think that this position could probably utilize a voluntary survey aspect. And we really do. When we first went to privatize a lot of mental health years ago, there was always talk about taking a look back. We never have. We really don't know what we're doing, what's going on out there, as we contract so much of mental health and so many services through DSS and everything out. So I like the idea.
Same.
I don't know about us, but you know, doing it internally, I want to grow the office, but I didn't envision that. But I support this generally.
And I think to answer your point about, you know, determining what's out there and people's, you know, whether they're getting the services that they want, that other thing would be done. So this is sort of mirrored after what I'm used to at the hospital in Elmville is. We do patient. Our analyst goes over patient satisfaction surveys. They take that information to determine where are we missing, where are we not hitting the marks on things, and it helps us to do it. And that's what that person does. Reviews all those patient satisfaction surveys. In this case, it would be consumer or public, you know, surveys, and determine from there, do we have gaps in coverage? Do we have gaps in what services we're providing? So, question, Walter.
Sure. As someone who does those patient satisfaction surveys over and over again, I would not suggest we do a countywide survey.
Yeah.
But I do would like to see that this position incorporates the data, and I know I'm calling it the wrong thing before you tell me I am, Chris, but I still like calling it 311211 because I think it's the only thing I can remember as opposed to that crazy long number.
Constituent Services Navigator.
I know, 311211 sounds so cool. But yes, there's the data that we get, which I imagine they get many, many calls all the time with specifics on what their needs are, that I would, it would be great if this position integrated not only the Schedule C deliverables of all of our different, whenever there's a Schedule C, but also align that with what the actual data is coming in from the constituent services. And that's a way we can see how they parallel.
Deputy Controller Gallagher.
So I just want to read a section of the charter for you. 57C sub I. Submit to the county legislature and executive and post on the county website as frequently as he or she deems necessary, but at least quarter annually, reports on the financial condition of the county and the economy, efficiency and or effectiveness with which the county government or any of its departments, agencies, or programs are managed. We consider contracts with outside agencies fully within our purview. I would welcome an additional staff person. We have approved 792 contracts for Ulster County in 2022. So I would not be in support of this position being outside of the auditor's office. I think, you know, we would love additional resources to be able to dive more deeply. I just got a question from a county legislator this week asked me about community action. I sent back five community action contracts. We currently have five contracts with community action, and that is one of the smaller agencies that we're working with. I actually think that one person would drown in this position and that it's going to take a team. So I just want you to know I consider this within our charter responsibilities. We welcome additional resources, and I'm happy to answer any questions on specific contracts.
And I will say the controller's office is one of my initial thoughts is where this would go, but I think there was more support if it was in the legislative office, so that's why I had switched it. Deputy Senator Kelly? Get your hand up.
Ulster County Service Center. I came up with Constituent Service Navigator, and as a kind of a technocrat, that's why that's a confusing thing. So they changed it to Service Center, and decided this makes more sense. That's it.
I just want the phone number to still be
cool. Legislative KM.
Yeah. So back to the whole, where does this sit, right? The legislature or the comptroller's office? I mean, just on the surface, it screams comptroller to me.
Right.
And so what would be the reason why we would want to keep it in the legislative office versus, you know, putting it in the comptroller's office? Because you said you thought about it a little bit.
Well, that, it was, for my answer, it's to get support to get this passed. I agree with you. I think, to me, it felt natural for it to go into the comptroller's office, but there wasn't support for that. So several people had said they wouldn't support it that way when I talked to them individually. So that's it, Ron.
I was going to say something similar. I wouldn't support it that way. So,
Chair Bartels?
Yeah, I mean, I have to really think about it. I like it conceptually, although I also struggle with where it would live. It does seem like it makes more sense in the comptroller's office based on the charter description of duties of both offices. That said, you know, I think it would involve, and I would hope that you could have a conversation with the comptroller, because obviously, as a legislative initiative, I mean, I don't say obviously, I would think that the legislature would want some level of ability, if this were something we move forward with in, and I'm speaking ahead because you and I haven't spoken about this, in the comptroller's office, the legislature would want some level of ability to say these are the things we want to see in collaboration versus here's just more resources. Because I think what you're hearing in the initiative is that the legislature yearns to have some more detail on specific comments. I'm sure you have certain contracts. I'm sure you have certain ones that you want to look at, right?
I think. Yeah, and I will say, with our current controller, I don't feel that any time I've asked for something that I've not gotten it. So I feel like I can say that has been pretty well working. You can't speak to the future, and, you know, hopefully that wouldn't be the case, that somebody would change their opinion on how they work with the legislature, but I feel like it's been a good relationship so far since I've been here. So, Legislator Cahill.
Yeah, so could we do this? This is going to be through you. It's actually a question to you, yeah, the chair and the comptroller, right? Is this something that we could do in the job description? If we do add it into the comptroller's office, where we say this job description will be, you know, to support the initiative of the legislature or something like that, where the job would report, where the staff and the support and expertise does lie in the comptroller's office, right? But, you know, kind of like under our direction, right? Something like that. Now, I think that's probably a reasonable solution to this, because I 100% agree with what we're doing here.
I think that's a great suggestion, and I also want to mention that we've been talking about adding a legislative survey to our risk assessment process. We've realized that we have 23 people who really think about county government all the time, and we haven't been asking the legislators, what do you see as the most risky areas, or what do you think the comptroller's office should be focused on? Yeah, I mean, I think there could be easily written in some sort of, you know, number of reports back or number of contracts identified by the legislature annually or something like that. Again, I said the volume of contracts is very, very high, so we have to do something that's reasonable and that's doable. Yeah.
Push it around.
I want to also state that, you know, my objection to this being in the comptroller's office has nothing to do with our current comptroller, but has to do with the volatility that comes with, you know, the election of a comptroller every 4 years. So it's not always going to be our current comptroller, you know, and I'm not only worried about the future, but also what's happened in the past. So.
Chair Bartels.
Thanks. Yeah, I think Legislator Cahill, it's an excellent suggestion. You know, that the authority to provide for additional staff and even deputies in the comptroller's office is squarely, a new, you know, spelled out in the charter, and it lies with the legislature. So I think, you know, back to my earlier discussion about being specific about the deputy's qualifications, again, happy that we have a very qualified current deputy, but making sure that stays in whatever distant future. I think we could do the same thing with a position like this. We could be very specific about what we were looking for in terms of the connectivity to the legislative office. But I will also say, and I think that you're right in terms of drowning in this. There's a lot to look at. There's a lot of contracts. But I will also say that the comptroller has regularly reached out to the legislature, as long as she's been comptroller, saying, what do you want us to look at? We haven't always been forthcoming, but there's no... That's because there's so much to look at, and we're so deep in what we're doing too. So I think it's worthy of another conversation. I don't know who you spoke to, other than maybe one who's spoken up right now saying that they wouldn't support it in that office. But I think it's a worthwhile conversation.
Thank you, Legislator Green. You're up.
Okay. Should I come up there?
Yes, please.
Amendment that I am sponsoring came out of a discussion where the basis for the discussion is that telecommuting is a climate solution. And we've just been through a couple of years of using telecommuting because of COVID. But then the rules changed, and we went back, and we have to be present in person with some minor exceptions. And by the way, many of us just went to Saugerties one night and Ellenville another, and had very, very few people show up, even though 23 of us or 20 of us made that drive. What I am concerned about and suggesting is that we try to create a hybrid so that the public has the greatest access to participate but doesn't have to drive from the long distance that this county encompasses. And I think I raise the question often because of the example of the Climate Smart Committee, where we have people from all over the county that are working on climate solutions in their community, and the best way for them to communicate is through the Climate Smart Committee. And that was working really well before, which I want to acknowledge Legislator Petit is responsible for creating. And it was working very well. And then during COVID, it flourished because people could participate from around the county. When we had to start meeting live, 3 to 5 people instead of 20 to 30 were participating. And I think that that the people that are actually appointed to the committee should have to come to the county building and or wherever we're publicly announced meeting is held, but to get the widespread participation. And that's just one committee. I expect this applies to other committees across the board, but that was my direct experience where I became, I think, a squeaky enough wheel that I ended up sponsoring an amendment, and I thank you, and I hope you'll consider it, and I'll take any questions.
Yes.
Well,
oh,
yes, I like this, and I think it's wonderful to do that we kind of expand our staff.
Use your mic, Jeff.
And I don't think it has to be limited to this. This is a full-time person. I don't think they'd just be limited to just, online meetings or things like that. There's other things that we can do in the legislature that this person could be doing. I'd love to get to the point where when you get on our calendar, you can get that day's agenda just by clicking on the calendar and things like that. But we just don't have downtime in the office. We just don't have enough people to do the things we need to do. And if we're going to be a true co-equal branch of government, we need, a larger tech presence and an online presence and the ability to do some of the things you talk about even more than that. So I'm for this position.
Thank you. And I want to say that, you know, I kept asking, well, can't we? And then the point was raised that if I'm going to be facilitating a meeting, I can't, even if I learned how to do some of the technical things that are required, I can't facilitate a meeting and be, you know, handling the technical part of it. So I think there's, I think we'll come into the 21st century.
So with the restrictive rules that we have for in-person meetings, and they are very restrictive, right? So this would really be for public participation in our committee meetings and in the what legislature we already have, but in just general committee meetings and commission meetings and things like that, where we feel like the public may want to engage more and give them the opportunity to, through like a Zoom link, is that what we're talking about? And then, you know, with that said, so then, you know, some of the other things in there that I see in the description about, you know, doing things like the software and hardware. I mean, we have an IS department, right? And so we understand that their support level that we get from the IS department may not be ideal. But we think I think that's, you know, been, I wouldn't go any further than that, but I'll say that, you know, if we could improve on that, get a committee from IS, and you know, for that aspect, I don't disagree with the ability to have, you know, Zoom meetings for our committee meetings and letting the public participate in any way they can, right? And if it means, you know, over a phone call or a Zoom meeting, great, I'm all for that. And from that aspect, then it is tricky, you know, to do that sometimes, right? And as you said, you can't sit here and let people in and out of a room and answer chats and run a meeting. So we definitely would be looking at something like that. I don't disagree.
So the position right now we have, we contract out for our recording of our session nights. Would you envision this would replace that?
No. They
okay.
would supplement that. I don't expect that contract would help the particular problem I just stated with the climate smart communities where, you know, 20 or 30 people want to participate, but are now hampered by the fact that they can't do it electronically. Anyone who wants to come to where the meeting is held is certainly welcome to, but it just would give the public or, you know, interested stakeholders better access to our meetings. And we would still do it within the confines of the law that require that the appointed people are here in person or, you know, go through. But I don't see this as, I think that's a different function. I think this is assisting the committees to have better participation, but not adding mileage and fossil fuel and such.
All right. Thank you. Chair Bartels.
Thank you.
So my First Amendment, Amendment number 23, has to do with the Board of Elections, both the commissioners and the deputy commissioners. We had a discussion about this last cycle when we did the one-time payout for election employees, and the deputy commissioners did not at that time get paid out because they were deputies. We know that the deputies, they do get comp time, but that comp time has to be utilized in a certain amount of time. So given all the hours that they work and to reflect, I looked at comps across our neighboring counties and thought that it was fair to simply move their hours from 75 to 80, which I think you could, they're all here and they could speak to it. They work considerably more than that. We all know that the election cycle is also changed significantly from years ago, where
there was significant downtime, and then on time now, pretty much a year-round operation. So that move from 75 to 80 hours provides the adjustment that you see in front of you, bringing the commissioners of election from 94.22 to 96.450, and the deputies from 73.17 to 75.005, but in both cases it increases hours. So we know with commissioners though that it's not really an hourly job. Department heads aren't working on the hours. And I'm happy to let them speak to how many for the deputies, how many hours were basically forsaken because they couldn't use the comp time. But I'll take any questions if you've got them.
Joe.
I always like to talk about the salary. I never like taking, it's one thing to take a union position and add hours or something, because they really are clocking in and out. We know how many hours a lot of these department heads work. Let's just talk about the salary. I don't like just moving hours up and saying, well, we just gave them more hours when it's...
I am actually talking about the salary, not the hours. I'm just telling you how I arrived at the salary, because the hours in these cases are essentially irrelevant. I agree with you 100% and have been part of that argument over and over as it relates to department heads and their deputies.
Legislator Kalin.
Thanks. So for pension purposes, don't we have to document the hours that we work? If you're doing that, it's somewhere, I know that we have to document an hours for the pension plan, right?
I don't know that it affects it, because you can't earn more than a year's worth of service time. So
whether they're 37 and a half hour
or 40, I don't think that affects their final average.
Thanks.
That's more for part-time employees. Full-time employees earn a year of service credit. Part-time employees have to document their time in order to be able to earn that much service credit.
I don't participate in it, so I have
no worries. Anybody else?
Does anybody want to hear from the commissioners in relation to how many hours, especially as it relates to the deputies? Everybody's good.
Okay. I just have some comments.
Okay.
Sorry.
That's okay.
So I'd be more supportive of salary increases for the for the lower level employees at the Board of Elections rather than the commissioners. The commissioners, again, they're the only department heads that are employed solely based on a recommendation from the political parties, not necessarily from I don't want to say experience, because they're both experienced, but. I also think that we're giving some rather hefty increases. I'm thinking of our staff later on. I've got an amendment to bring for our staff, but I would again rather see the lower level employees get the increases.
So, in a moment I can bring it up, although it's not on the agenda, so I can't strictly speak to it today. I have more amendments tomorrow.
Okay.
But there is, as came out of laws and rules, I am bringing forward the amendment for the position requested by both commissioners to be increased, which is a technical a position that was new to the office but brought a lot of technical expertise, and both commissioners agree that those positions should be raised to reflect a higher salary, and also will have a title change with it, just so that it's not the same title at a higher rate.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll bring that tomorrow, and the commissioners could actually speak to that today if the chair would allow it. But if I could, before I do that, just speak to the issue of the commissioners. You didn't speak to the deputies. So if we're just talking about the commissioners, well, yes, they are appointed by this body. There's no doubt that both these commissioners, in my mind, are highly experienced and skilled, and the demand of the job has grown tremendously. Again, in the time that I've been here, it's changed significantly in terms of the election cycle, many of the updates to election law that require they can speak to it better than I, but basically year-round workload. And so I do think it's warranted, and that's independent of them being political appointees. But if I may, would you like to hear from the commissioners while they're here on the amendment to you'll see tomorrow for the position?
I mean, I have no need to, but if they would like to speak, I'm happy to listen to you.
There's a couple of legislators that weren't here on Thursday. I have no problem speaking to it. So we were very thankful that you gave us two new positions this past year, in which they originally started out as just additional clerks. The two individuals that we were fortunate enough to hire to fill those positions were so overly qualified as clerks that they immediately took on additional roles and responsibilities in our office that alleviated a lot of the additional stress from the new election laws. And they've essentially jumped in on almost every aspect of our office, whether it be from helping the machine techs to our absentee administrators, and whether it's even the bag packing that gets done prior to the election. They've essentially become like the master utility people for our office. And I could not see any way that we left them at the clerk pay without coming and arguing that they at least be recognized for a little bit of a title change and be known as, I think we're calling them administrative technicians, because they have been able to jump in on a moment's notice and anything to do with our technical stuff for our machine techs, as well as keeping the flow of all the clerk work done in a timely manner.
I do just want to add that they also help us tremendously with cybersecurity protections to our office, which has become a much more heightened part of the work that we've done in the last couple of years. So they routinely help us out when we are asked by the State Board of Elections to produce that information, which is oftentimes very technical, and then we are also working with the IS department. We have now pre-canvas of absentee ballots, which means we count them before Election Day. About 75% of the ballots that we get through the mail are part of the Election Night canvas, and they are a big part of that effort, and they work the technical end of it. It's a much more highly skilled job than the clerk level, and they help us out with that performance as well with the clerk work. Do you want us to speak to the deputy positions? I think it's informative.
If you just want to provide the information for the record.
Happily. So it's not just 2020. 2020 sort of started with our new amount of election reforms that we've been working with. It also was the pandemic year. In that year, the deputies earned a combined 281.25 hours, Deputy Quigley clocking in at 110.25, and Deputy Fuentes with 171. That's over their 105 limit. That's not altogether, that's in excess of the 105, which is already a higher ceiling than other management positions, which is a 35-hour ceiling. That is a lot of work that they did that year. In 2021, the deputies earned a collective 182.25, Fuentes 90.75, and Deputy Williams 91.5. They're laughing because they're probably remembering how they don't ever really leave the office. And then this year, with the special election adding more hours, they've earned actually more than in 2020, combined 299.25 since January. Fuentes 149, Williams 150.25. They have reached their ceiling twice, once in August and again just this past week. So we do manage them. We do force them to take time off, but the work just has to get done. And the work of the board is often timely, and we have statutory requirements that put us on deadlines, which we actually have to go because we're on a deadline right now.
Yeah, and if I just might add to Legislator Maloney's comment, only as it relates to the deputies, moving them to 80 hours will actually just slightly help with that hour issue, because it'll mean that their ceiling hits a little bit later.
That 5 hours over the 27 pays would essentially
eliminate any of this extra comp time, that and essentially compensate them for that work rather than having to earn that comp time and bank it or lose it.
Next one, the next resolution, proposed amendment number 24, is moving the confidential secretary of budget into the county executive's office. You'll recall that a couple of years ago, under then legislator Archer, she made the proposal to basically right-size the executive's office and have the executive's office reflect the work that was being done in the executive's office. At that time, there was an agreement to do that, but to phase it in, and we moved most all, I think, but for this position into that office. So this is the last one.
Deputy Mayor Kelly.
So to that point, it doesn't reflect the actual duties of the position, and we would request time to provide the job description and the actual work being performed.
Okay. What you mean?
It's not. The position is currently not doing exclusively county executive work, so it's inaccurate to say that it's the county executive position. There's significant budget work, and it's part of the overall budget processes during the year that this position is performing. So I just think that it we have to have a bit more of a discussion regarding the actual day-to-day work.
Okay. Are you suggesting that the position is strictly a budget position?
No.
Okay.
It's roughly 80-20.
80-20 what?
80 budget, 20 exactly.
Correct.
Where does the person physically work?
It works upstairs in this floor, sixth floor, along with 3/4 of the budget team.
Where's the desk?
Where's the desk? The desk is, there's two desks out front, so one is, so that's one.
Okay, what amount of time do you think you'll need?
So that's, we're currently preparing those things
okay.
as part of the transition, so I figured it's a dual purpose that we can also provide it to you.
Perfect.
So it's the work starting.
Great, thank you.
Yep.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah,
okay. So this is technically new business or whatnot, because some of this stuff, got a kid getting her tonsils out tomorrow, and it was rescheduled, so I'm not going to be able to be
microphone.
Here, but I can talk real quick about it. We don't have some of the printouts, but I'll explain some of the things I'm on with other legislators, so tomorrow they'll be able to speak to it. Some I may be alone on, so I'll go through them real quick if anybody wants to talk. I don't think we need to talk about the Ken can handle some of these things, I think. So ARPA, look, I think we have 42 new positions or whatever, so I don't think anybody needs to lose their job. We can find a home for them if that's a concern. But I've just gotten to the point where I'm just going to be brutally honest about what I think about these ARPA positions. And when I was watching from afar, I disagreed with creating them. Some other legislators did as well. But the way it was described, we were getting a guru that was going to be leading the charge and helping us come up with innovative ways to spend this money. And I haven't seen it. When I have a question about ARPA, when I heard it, when I hear anyone else have questions about ARPA, anything to do with ARPA, when I see presentations, I'm talking to Chris Kelly, I'm talking to Tim Wiederman, I'm talking to Mark Ryder, I'm talking to Amber, and I'm talking to Natalie. We're paying somebody $115,000 a year. We're just about through those funds. There's quarterly filings, some of which are helped with by the EDA, which we fund the EDA to help us with some of that. And there's some online tracking for the community. That's what I've come up with. I mean, it's a lot of money. We can find, we have these new open positions that we can slide them into. It was meant to sunset. I think now is the time to sunset. Anyone have any?
Debbie Ziv Kelly.
So these positions were not intended to come up with the projects. These positions were meant to manage reporting, and that is what they are doing. We spent the first 6 months of this year appropriating significant sums of money. What this team actually does is, in the background, they are facilitating the application process, facilitating creating the contracts, interaction with all the applicants, and they're doing this across approximately, at this point, close to $30 million in projects. Their workload will continue in a very significant manner for the next couple of years because of the reporting requirements. The EDA is not doing the reporting on the ARPA project. That's the ARPA team.
I think we did a lot of this without somebody was out on maternity leave. We managed the function.
If you attend the ARP meetings, you will see significant interaction between Nate as the project director and the other staff and that entire committee. So I would defer to legislators Criswell, Corcoran, and others on that committee about the interaction they have with the ARPA team on a regular basis regarding their work. Thank you.
I and others have attended quite a bit of ARPA. I'm just telling you, I don't see it. And to be honest with you, we don't always get honest feedback. You never want to give us anything when we tell you, we complain about UCAT. Everything's fine. Then he's terminated. He was fine right up until he was terminated. I think this is another example of that. And I just hope legislators use their own eyes and ears and experiences. And if you think we need these three positions for some kind of administrative filings behind the scenes, I don't buy it. And we can go back and watch the meetings. Chair, you were there. That's not what we did not say, hey, we're getting these three positions. I remember Donaldson at the time talking a lot about them. We were not told, look, these are going to be behind-the-scenes people that are just going to be filing things. There's all these millions of filings. They're going to be doing all this we need. And $115,000 a year, if that is, it's somewhere around there. By the way, I think we, for the first time, are these the positions that we're funding their fringe out of county funds and not out of ARPA? That's not, these aren't the positions. No.
The ARPA revenue doesn't cover the division in full.
It does. No. Yeah, that's when the revenue.
We can look at it.
Yep.
Chair Bartels?
Well, why are we seeing it differently? Can we figure that out?
Let's talk about it.
We have our computers. Can we figure this one out? Maybe Nate can go.
Chair Bartels?
So, okay, we have two things in front of us, but it's not that one, right? So we have two other ones?
I don't know if I went and I don't know if you guys.
We
I don't
only
know if
we
I
have
went.
Tourism
and two deputies.
I have
two deputies. Okay, so let me just
assistant
speak to this
deputies.
For a second.
Yeah.
Yeah, assistant.
If you'd like me to talk, those these are things that we're going to be arguing
can I,
tomorrow.
But before
right?
you, because I know you won't be here tomorrow, can we just run this one? So yes, I remember when this came up and questioning the need for three people. We had the back and forth. We used the ARPA funds, and it was time limited. It was only going to be for the 3 years. Is that correct? Tops. I can say that given how quickly we're moving through the ARPA funds and how much ARPA has to administer, I think they really actually have their hands full because we have a lineup of approvals that are yet to be completed. We have the for-profit that they're working through. We have the ag coming. We have the small business. We just finished the not-for-profit. We had they're engaged in all of that, to my mind.
An administrative engagement. I think it was one of our analysts put in their report prior to this last term that. Where they had said something about it's going to be tough to find, the kinds of people you want, at these other counties at this structure. We've waited this long to hire somebody. I think you're forgetting the conversations around what we were getting. It was not administrative, budgetary, behind the scenes work. It wasn't. We were getting more than that, and I think we can do that. These are budget amendments. Not budget pork. I think we forget that. What I've heard today is just that adding on. Where are we finding money? The budget will be $400 million, $450 million, $500 million. Eventually, if we don't start, tightening up, we won't have an honest conversation. And we always say, I heard it today. Well, if the with grants. Well, if we don't, we could always refuse it, and but we could always end it if we're not liking what they're doing. We never do. I mean, this is a situation where if you really just take an honest look, and if we want to keep them, they're good. Move them somewhere else. This is not what these barcode positions. I don't know. That's all I can say. Don't then leave them.
Legislative team.
I agree with Legislator Maloney on this. I've been looking at the budget, too, and, you know, granted, even though it's not increasing taxes, we're pulling money out of somewhere else. Next year's not going to be good. We're not going to be getting ARPA money. We may get some infrastructure money, but we have to be really careful about putting on so many new positions. We already have 42. I think I lost count with the new positions that have been proposed. I think there's another 20. Minimally, if we were going to keep this ARPA committee, then perhaps we should require them to put in for grants too, because we do need grant writers. But now we have somebody who's administering basically a $35 million grant and somebody who's going to be writing more grants with an administrator there. It's a lot of duplicated efforts. We've only gone through, I think, as far as the funding goes, we're still waiting to see who the 15 municipalities were who were awarded the 12 different for the water and sewer infrastructure. I did speak to one supervisor last night at Wawarsing who said they did get it, but the nonprofits are also on hold. They're waiting to get their money. Did they get it? I mean, I'm trying to figure out what, you know, where we're going with this, and this is just supposed to be a temporary department. So I think if we created something full-time, put the grant writers in, let them finish up with this funding, because basically they'll be distributing grants instead of writing them. We have to look at ways to cut back on these positions that are being created where they are receiving legacy costs. Even this particular, you know, department is going to be getting COLA, so they are employees.
Debbie's here. Kelly.
So we have communicated to the 15 municipalities that their awards are pending legislative approval. I've also communicated to Legislator Petit and several other legislators that the 40-plus contracts for not-for-profits have been moving forward. The reason you haven't seen all of those is because they're under $50,000. So we've been rolling them through in 20 batches of 20 through the county attorney's office. So all of those things are moving forward, and every aspect of that is being managed by the ARPA team. These are
a report
on what?
I mean,
report directly to the ARP committee, and we have been in communication on all aspects of this to them, including who's been awarded, who hasn't been. I think it was 1 or 2 months ago that we published the entire list of who was in receipt of the non-for-profit awards.
I have not gotten one spiel like this from Nate. Not one. All I hear is I'm learning. I'm learning a lot.
I thought
this big ARPA position would be what I hear coming from you all the time, half the time. I don't need it.
Here we go.
I don't need that.
Let's stay on topic.
Do I need laughing and faces?
Let's stay on topic here.
That is on topic. I mean, you can defend all you want. We haven't gotten what we were promised. If we go back and watch those meetings from a year or two ago, we are not getting what we thought we were getting. Watch the conversations.
Chair Bartels.
I mean, the one thing that I would be really concerned about in getting rid of those positions prematurely would be, and to Legislator Petit's point, would be so we remove the three positions, but then who's actually going to do all the work to get all the things that we passed through? I mean, it takes...
The same people doing the work now.
It takes a considerable amount of work. And right now, that's being run through the ARPA division. If it's the new grant writers, they're not going to be able to write grants. They're going to be running these grants. I mean, the ARPA committee does get regular updates on the status of all the approvals, the spending, and where it's at. Well, the ARPA committee until recently had two meetings per month. One meeting was like an intro to what was going to be a first time at a proposal, as Legislator Green's nodding, because sometimes you go through multiple times at the ARPA committee. And at that same meeting, there would be a status report given. Now they're down to one meeting, but you could possibly have attended one where it wasn't the status meeting.
Correct.
Hmm?
It is being provided to the clerk office.
Oh, yeah. There's
so I could ask for Favela to send that to
for the ARPA backup? Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Next, once again, it's just we don't function anywhere close to what a private. Okay, there's just no accountability. What did we want to do next? Tourism?
Sure.
Another little loop, I'm sure. So, I've spoken to it in economic development a little. You know, I asked a question the other day, is there ever too much tourism? Every person that we now lure into this county to stay overnight, I'd say not every person, 75% to 90% of them are staying in someone's former home or apartment. So we're unique, one of the most unique counties. I mean, you can make the argument the entire country and beyond with our proximity between New York City and Albany. I don't know if our tourism department and the money we spend could really track in any real provable way that you wouldn't have the same amount of people here at this point. They're coming. Our location and what we have here is driving it. And now we've gotten to a point where, with short-term rentals, where I would say the majority of these overnight tourists are staying, is now driving, in many ways, our housing crisis. So the idea that we're out there in coffee shops, or there's a budget line that has something to do with hats. We might be flying our tourist director to Europe, I think, this year or something. I just think we have to do. I used to hear an awesome legislator from the southern part of the county talk about take a year and cut tourism spending for 1 year and then compare it and see if there's even a difference. That's true. That legislator is now our chair. So I just think it's time to pivot with tourism, and we need our tourism to be less about pamphlets and magazines and coffee shops in New York City, and more about almost being a liaison and guarding against certain aspects of tourism. A tourism-based economy is not necessarily a good thing. You know, hearing Brian Wolfman speak the other day, he's making all these points about one of the contributing factors to our housing crisis being a lack of manufacturing and industrial jobs. So I just think we need to really pivot spending. Look, if you're going to find places, we're supposed to be finding places to cut spending at times. And if you're looking for places to cut spending, I think advertising in tourism, paying some company in Texas and Oklahoma a couple hundred grand a year to try to sell people on coming to Ulster County when we're bursting at the seams. We literally have no room, and on top of it, I don't think anything we're doing or spending any money on is the reason they're coming. They're coming. Look at where we're at. Look at what we have. I just don't think $700,000-$900,000 needs to be spent essentially on advertising. I've separated it out at least at $250,000 to the Oklahoma Texas firm. I think we could do without. Thoughts?
Mr. Kim.
Yeah, so I got two things. Number one, if we could get the surrounding counties to do the same thing, I'd be with you. But the minute we don't do what Orange County, Dutchess, Columbia, Sullivan are doing, then we're the ones that are going to be in the rearview mirror, because they'll go there because they see it and they see advertising. Advertising works, right? And our tourism department does an excellent job. They just won 2 state awards, right, for their advertising. So I have no issue with their advertising. As a matter of fact, I would think of increasing it, maybe to expand our base a little, get more people coming, because you said something, and I'm like, where did this come from? You said that 75 to 90% of the people here are staying in houses. Is that what you're saying, in Airbnbs?
Well, hotels, I think you got to the point with we're the Airbnb capital.
Well,
when you look at the numbers.
Where are you getting that number?
Look at the number of Airbnbs we have.
We contract
with a company.
How can you possibly stand up there and say that 75 to 90% of the people coming into this county for tourism?
I think it'd be regional, but yeah, I stand by that.
Well, prove it. Just give me one way to prove it. That's
prove
all I'm asking.
Well, well, first of all, I have a retail business that I speak to hundreds of people a week. It's rare somebody tells me they're staying in a hotel. They're all tourists. They're all staying in Airbnbs. Like I said, regional. Maybe sororities in the northern part of the county is more than some parts of some other parts of the county.
Well, there's some, but there's very few hotels there.
Prove to me what a penny that you've spent on one of these, like how. First of all, we have all. If we're in competition with Orange County, maybe we should take their magazines out of the thing downstairs. But the idea that these magazines drop, I just don't. It's we're past that point of driving toward. If you really think government dollars is why people are here, you and me are just living in two different worlds.
So one of the awards that,
and back to what you just said, I stand by it.
Well,
I want like many people
gentlemen.
I'm just saying, show me where you got the data, because I'm a data guy. I want to see where that 75% to 90% came from. Because
well,
if that's a reality,
contract with the firm that gives us the Airbnb.
Legislative Maloney, that's
so
one at a time.
If we can get that 75% to 90%, you know, quantified somewhere, I'll be happy. I just want to see it, because you said it as if it was like, oh, you know, everybody knows this. I don't know that.
You don't know how, you don't know the short-term rental market in Ulster County is booming, like.
I do know that.
Okay.
What I'm saying is that I don't believe that 75% to 90% of the visitors to Ulster County are
okay,
staying in the Airbnb, right? I just don't believe that, right? So the second thing I was going to say was the one of the awards that they won was for data-driven tourism, using data to drive their plan and to get success from that plan. So, I mean, you know, if you want to, if you don't think that works, then, you know, that's fine. That's your belief. But I firmly believe that if they're getting state-level awards, right, for their advertising, and especially for a data-driven advertising award, then I think they're doing a good job.
I think Albany giving our tourism department an award doesn't mean much. But you and I have a very different approach, and that's obvious.
Anybody else?
More tourism spending. Okay. Next. Do we want to get into these positions? Deputy executive,
assistant.
The assistant deputy executive positions. Over in Dutchess County, now we don't want to compare to Dutchess County anymore. They have, I think, what are they, a third the size bigger than we are population-wise. I can prove that. And they have, I believe, one deputy. Do they have one deputy and two assistants, or two deputies and one assistant? I just thought now's the time we function. We haven't held up, and I talk about this here and there, we haven't held up one project. During all these campaigns, all these people leaving, we've never heard, you know what, we're going to postpone that, we're going to put that, we're going to ask the legislature not to act on that a couple of months, because we just don't have the staff. Maybe I heard Chris mention it one time on one thing. So we've functioned all this time, we've done everything perfect, we postpone nothing, we keep moving on all these projects, and we've done it without these assistants. It was a bloated number compared to other counties that are very comparable. I mean, I don't know if you could be much more comparable than Dutchess. And that's that. We don't have the positions now. It's a beautiful thing. We don't have to fire anybody. And we kind of undo something that probably should have never been done. Thoughts? Okay. That was pretty much it. I think Ken can handle the other ones tomorrow.
Anybody else? If not, can I have a motion to adjourn?
Move to adjourn.
Second. That's a favor.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. 5:30, everyone. Thank you.